tabled seminar to welcome in particular those making representations. Just to remind you, we advertise in the public domain in various languages. Zukiswa and Olivia, if we can please have your cooperation. To say that, firstly, this is really chaired primarily by Charles Zafir, the chair of the Select Committee, but he's explained to me that for various reasons, he wants me to take primary responsibility, and then he will do the real date. He will do the budget public hearings in the first quarter of next year, February next year. So welcome, everybody. To explain that we have separated, ideally we trusted the trade unions together, but because of time arrangements, the representatives of the various federations, the federal production, couldn't come at the same time. So we got them separated. I don't know, Charles, you want to say a few words before we start with the process?
Thank you, Chairperson Turin. Excuse me. The Select Committee for Finance has three members here present in this public hearing. Why? Finance and Appropriations in the NCOP is the same members in the two committees. Only the chairperson that's the different people, and three of our members are attending the Appropriation Committee with the Standing Committee on Appropriations, getting the inputs from the FSC. So the FSC will join us later on the agenda after the committee at the Appropriations Committee. So we've got three members here present. So there will be three apologies to the Secretary that you must just note. And this is an exercise of public participation with Parliament, specifically the finance committees, are listening to stakeholders to make their input on a very important document. The MTBB is setting the basis and tone for next year's national budget and the outer year. So, Chairperson Garin, I'm handing back to you.
I would also welcome Mr. Brandon Popham as a new member. The DA feels that two members alone are not enough because they are completely swamped and overwhelmed by the quality and, very important, the quantity of arguments they get from the ALD side. So by the end of this year, you can expect that we'll have about 7 or 8 finance committee members from the DA side. It will make no impact. It's not quantity that counts, quality. But Mr. Chopin, you are most welcome. Henri Pierre Blanche from the DA is here. He's a new member, isn't he?
Yes.
New member.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome to you. We've seen you around.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's have formalities about this. This is the real reason why Charles is not chairing, primarily, he's still chair. It's because he feels he cannot control finance committee members from the ANC side. So, but I mean the two DA members in particular. So he said, let's take over. Now, okay, over to you. Those who are participating, we got your representation to us in writing, even in cases where you've written a slide. So you don't have to take the full 20 minutes, but you have those 20 minutes. You, in fact, might want to give some space so that we can question you. And it's better to hear what we have to say about what you say than simply say what you say and don't have enough space. Also, to finance standing committee members of the National Assembly side, just to alert you that the last week of the last quarter where we vote on all our standing reports and minutes has to be dispensed with for the reasons we've covered, and I don't want to cover that again. It was meant to be a committee week, so we'll have to vote on those things. It's embarrassing that the minutes for the whole of the last quarter have not been adopted, and the outstanding report of the study tool remains that Ayers will take responsibility for because I couldn't attend to the report. We'll have to vote on that separately. So we'll try to finish by 1, but we'll need 15 extra minutes, maybe, to finish the voting, and we'll need a quorum for that, please. Thank you very much. Over then to Pedusa.
Good morning, Chairperson and committee members. It's again an opportunity for us to look at the situation of the finances of the country, and we are grateful for the opportunity to engage with you today. I must say that Pedusa has also had an opportunity to engage with the Minister of Finance in Netherlands during last week, and we've also concluded some important agreements with the government in Netherlands regarding the retirement reform process and the taxation on that. But Chairperson, the budget, the medium-term budget policy statement is an important instrument for our country, specifically at this time, because the country is going through a situation of low growth, and we think and we believe it's important at this stage that we must, you know, put the necessary a process in place so that we can deal with it. But we also compliment this committee and the National Treasury, because South Africa is now ranked third out of 102 countries in terms of international budget partnerships, and that is something that is quite important for an African country to do that, because, you know, people look at Africa, they always look at us in a negative light. But for TUSA, what is quite important is the engagement inside of NEDLAC, because it shows to us that government is serious to engage with the main stakeholders, organized labor and business, to find solutions. Now, the issue of the priorities in terms of our whole process of the country, we want to say that quality education, skills development for employability, health and social protection, social and economic infrastructure, and the provision of decent jobs. That is what is summed up by President Zuma in his previous State of the Nation address. And we also want to encourage government from their side to stay fast and committed on those processes, because that, those are the foundations that will take our democracy forward. Let me move to slide number 3, Chairperson. And this is an area which we want to focus on. If you look at the National Development Plan and the 3 scenarios that have been outlined, so we are way under those particular targets for that scenario, and that is going to push this country into a situation that we will not be able to achieve our objectives in time. For instance, scenario 1 was talking about 3.3% growth rate, scenario 2 was talking about 4.8%, and scenario 3 was talking about 5.4%. Currently, National Treasury is projecting for 2015 that our economy will only grow at 15%. And we have already indicated to government that TUSA is ready and willing to work with government around the national summit, where we can look at the most important leverages to move the growth situation forward. And that is very important for us, because the country needs more substantial investments. We need to focus on strengthening our municipalities, specifically when it comes to service deliveries. And then thirdly, which we have already mentioned, is the issue of the education system. TUSA also thinks that the Department of Trade and Industry should provide incentives to support companies to expand so that we can strengthen our exports, while we also want the Department of Science and Technology should focus more on strengthening research and innovation, but also innovation in government programs, because this is where we can do more with less. The OECD chairperson argues that Africa could, for instance, make a difference in the area of growth. I think we're going to focus a lot of our attention on growth. And what we need to do, chairperson, is that government, business, and organized labor should work together so that we can address the bottlenecks. South Africa has a lot of bottlenecks in our economic systems. I can just give you, for instance, one example. I was listening to a radio station where one of our black entrepreneurs stood up and said, look, she had to close her business down because a government department did not pay this entrepreneur. And I mean, I could feel the pain of this person, taken her risk, invested the person's own money, only to find a government department doesn't do its work properly. So we can't continue with that. There has to be consequences for things like that. And we want to call on the government specifically to do something about that. Investment in infrastructure, and we have been spending a huge amount of money on that. I think those are one of the things that have helped us to only achieve the 1.5% growth. But I think that is also some area that we need to become more important. The private sector and the Reserve Bank report have indicated to us that the private sector is sitting on a huge amount of cash on the balance sheet, and a lot of the businesses are waiting. You know, we don't know what are they waiting for. You know, but I think now in the time, and this is also a biblical example, when things are going tough, people have to invest. And we want to call on our business people also to do the same. The issue on the budget and fiscal policy, and the budget is the most important part of that. From our side as producer, we also want to indicate to government there is still a lot of wasteful expenditure in government that could be addressed. And obviously from our side, we also feel that for government to reduce the deficit and to stabilize public debt, very important, because if you look at the interest on our public debt is now the highest expenditure in the total budget. We want to specifically direct you, Chairperson, to the area of the area that's going to help us to get growth going, and to focus on youth unemployment. And we saw with what young people can do if we don't direct the energies in the right direction. And that's the reason why we want to also just confirm our position that when government is going to look for funding to fund this issue of higher education, that the government should not take the money away from the skills fund. You know, government has to look at other areas where we can take those money away, but to also encourage the citizens at the same time to deal with these things. I've indicated already, Chairperson, that Hedusa is ready to work with government to address the binding constraint in the economy. Now, we have already concluded in the past, I think it was about 5 different agreements with government. The first agreement that we concluded with government was when the former Deputy President Kalema was acting president, when the economy went into a serious crisis in 2008. We developed a plan, what is called the response to the global crisis. I think all members of the committee and also members of parliament, you know, should at this moment, you know, let us come together and work to create higher inputs of economic growth. Fedusa also supports a process of the operation Pikisa, I'm not sure if I pronounced it correctly. Government has invited Fedusa to be part of the Mayan Pikisa. Our colleagues are now spending 5 weeks together with business and with labor, somewhere in the Popo. They said they will only ask us to come at 1 or 2 days, because they said when we come, we will always mess up the province. So, but from our side, we want to work with government. We also help government to work on the electricity crisis. I must say that we are starting to make progress in that area. We haven't seen load shedding for some time. So it is proof that whenever our Africans come together, that we can find solutions to the problems. Fedusa will also have our own bilateral meetings with our colleagues from Business Leadership South Africa. Those are most of the listed companies on the stock exchange. We will also, as we did previously from our experience with the gold price and the other countries selling the gold and force the prices down, we've also managed internationally to go as business and labor, went and approached them. And in those days, I think Chairperson would recall the General Secretary of the ANC was still the General Secretary of the NUM when we went together to London to address those particular problems. First, let me move on to the area of state-owned enterprises. We have calculated that South Africa has 750 state-owned enterprise companies. But these companies, that everybody has their own agenda. We support the process that there must be legislation that determines salaries for CEOs, determine their mandate, and determine their objectives. We also want to ask the committee specifically to see the amount of money that is wasted in these state-owned enterprises and to play a much more specific role on that. Fedusa from our side will therefore then support the legislation, and please, we don't want the legislation to take 3 years to go through Parliament. I think we need to find a way to fast track it so that we can deal with those particular issues. On the structural economic reforms, Fedusa is also working with Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa in ELEC to address the issue of the minimum wages, because we need to also at the same time look at the poorest people in our society so that we can increase their incomes. That will also help to stimulate economic growth, but we also want to look on this issue of protracted island strikes. It is not right when workers go on strike or civil society go on strike that we must resort to violence, and we want to condemn any forms of violence, whether it's students or whether it's other people. We can't move forward, but we are working with government, and we hope to see that the President can, during the State of the Nation, make some announcements on our work that we've been doing there. I did mention, Chairperson, the issue of how to do business with and support black people. I think it's important if this committee could specifically appoint Chairperson about government departments having to pay entrepreneurs on time and within the 30 days period that labor and government have agreed. And people that don't pay the people on that, those people must be disciplined, even if they are members of the TUSA working for the state. The national indebtedness, President Zuma spoke to us about the particular issue about the national debt, and as we were saying now, government debt has increased from around 26% of GDP to 47% in March this year. You know, I think, you know, the country didn't have much of a choice to allow the debt to go forward, but we will need to sometimes start to reduce that debt. And if we can get economic growth to go higher, then we'll be able to deal with it. Papers on the issue of industrialization and decent jobs. Fedusa supported 37 billion in allocation for public employment programs to encourage decent work in the next 3 years. That estimated 6 million short-term jobs through the expanded public works program is important, and also the community work program. And then the 24 billion rand in tax incentives and 16 billion for direct funding to support industrialization initiatives, including manufacturing competitive enhancement programs, and the automobile production and development program is also something that is quite critical. The special economic zones and the two that have now also been announced, one for the Free State and also one for Gauteng, is critical, but we feel that from our side there must be an industrial Picasa has to be established, because that is the area where we can make a huge amount of impact. And those 5 weeks, I just hope that the committee members could find some time in there, but we should do at least attend some of these things. I think it's a huge learning curve, and I think it was also something very magical from President Zuma when he started to guide government in that direction. So it is something that is going to support the implementation of the development, national development plan, and it's quite critical for us to deal with that. Chairperson, I think I only got 2 minutes left. On fiscal policy side, to do supplement government over prioritizing the stabilization of the debt, as we already said, and with a gross loan debt increasing to 49% of GDP, and the cost of service those debts will now be 127 billion rand. It's a huge amount of money that we're spending on debt. And that's the reason why our suggestion to this committee is, number one, increase growth. Number two, spend the taxpayers' money wisely. You see, the thing that public servants spend other people's money the way they want to do, it's something that is totally unacceptable. And Chairperson, from outside, as we were saying previously, that the Federation, you know, is willing and ready to work with government, and we have done that in the past. And then finally, I've indicated in my opening comment that FEDUSA have indicated to the Minister of Finance that the introduction of the new taxation reforms could be implemented from the 1st of March 2015. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Svetlana Donova, and I represent the Viva La Bantwana. I'll be giving a presentation on our response to the medium-term budget policy. Perhaps I'll just, while we wait for the PowerPoint presentation to come up, I'll just like to introduce who we are and what we do. Viva La Bantwana is an NGO, which is funded by four private donors, and we are dedicated to promoting the scale-up of quality early childhood development services to the poorest 40% of the population aged from conception until the age of 6, or when the child enters formal schooling or grade R. Okay, that's the great plan. Thank you. Why are we doing this? This is the most crucial period for brain development in a person's life. And this is overwhelming evidence globally that the human brain undergoes its fastest period of growth. The fastest number of connections between synapses take place from the period of conception until the age of 5 or 6, depending on which literature you read. So, for example, I'll just give you a very quick one. A child's brain, a two-year-old brain, is 3 or 4 times as active and has 3 or 4 times the number of neural pathways and neural connections that an adult brain has. So just think about that potential that is sitting inside that child's head. So we work with government, and we work largely with the Department of Social Development and civil society partners to provide the implementation evidence to support provision of quality early childhood development services and to strengthen government systems for delivery, as well as the consensus needed to enable delivery of these services at scale. Next slide, please. So how does our work align to South Africa's objectives? I'm going to take you to the National Development Plan, Vision 2030, and I'm going to quote, "By 2030, we seek to eliminate poverty and reduce inequality. We seek a country wherein all citizens have the capability to grasp the ever-broadening opportunities available. Our plan is to change the life chances of millions of our people, especially the youth, life chances that remain stunted by our apartheid history." So how did the NDP propose to do this? To improve levels of employment, and here I'm referring to better paying jobs and better skilled jobs. So not simply unskilled labor, which does not bring home enough money to support families and to sustain communities. And the way that you get those jobs is to improve quality of education. Those two goals, which would bring us to our vision as a country, are founded upon early childhood development. Okay. So this is how it works. Okay, so we are sitting currently within that inner circle, in the cycle of poverty. Our children, most marginalized, most risk, most vulnerable, receive poor quality early childhood development. They go on to have poor educational outcomes, partly because the quality of education is poor, but also because early childhood development, quality early childhood development in the vital years, from conception until age 3 or 4, results, and it is scientifically proven, there is overwhelming evidence globally that the educational outcomes of a child who has received good quality ECD are much higher than a child who has not. So that child who has received the poor quality ECD goes on to perform badly at school, and he finish school if he finishes school and goes on to have a low earning potential. He establishes a poor household and has children who also receive poor quality early childhood development, and there is a cycle of poverty. So what we are working for is that error that is coming from the bottom left-hand corner of my diagram, and that is investment in early childhood development. That is what we need to be doing in order to provide the good quality early childhood development. This is the only way to provide quality of opportunity, one of the fundamentals of democracy. So I'm just going to, I don't have this on my slide, but I'm just going to quickly talk to it. So what is the evidence suggesting of the benefits of early childhood development? Societal outcomes are better health outcomes, better safety in communities, because children that have received good quality early childhood development services are less likely to engage in violent behavior. They are less likely to abuse drugs or alcohol or to engage in risky behavior. They have a high earning ability and they have higher education outcomes, which I alluded to earlier. Now, the graph that you see in front of you right now is an adaptation of James Heckman's graph. James Heckman is an award-winning, Nobel award-winning economist who lives in the U.S., and he's regarded as the preeminent economist or on early childhood development services. So that graph shows you the returns in terms of human capital and human development of investment in education at different life stages. So you can see the highest return on investment for every rand spent in education for the period prenatal to 3 is much higher than the rand spent in tertiary education, and much higher than the rand spent in secondary education and primary education. We are spending in the exact opposite. And South Africa is spending this way, but in fact so are most countries around the world, because the scientific evidence around early childhood development has only emerged over the last 10, 15 years, and it's only been started to get adopted in policies in developed countries now. So we're spending in the opposite direction. So we spend the most in tertiary education and the least in early childhood education, which is actually where the biggest returns are. And I've got a stat here, so our per capita spend for primary and secondary education together is in the region of around 12,000 per capita per annum, and that's 22 times more than the average spend per capita for early learning. Why? Because children cannot process. They can't march to the union buildings, they don't have voice. In the most instances, the children who need these services the most are unseen and they're unheard, because they're living in small villages, in provinces which don't have the services they need. So when I'm talking about early childhood development services, what am I talking about? So this is the agreed upon package of essential services, and this is agreed with the Department of Social Development, the Children's Institute, and it's just, it's generally agreed. It's not something that the Botswana has, come up with independently. It's agreed that children need nutritional support, maternal and child primary health care intervention, stimulation for early learning, social services, and support for primary caregivers. And I'm going to focus on the early learning and support for primary caregivers here, and just give you a kind of snapshot of where we stand as a country at the moment. So more than 60% of our children under the age of 6 live in the poorest 40% of households, and they don't have access to these services. Only 40% of the poorest 20% of children have access to early learning. So their brains, in this most vital period of brain development, that is going to determine their lifelong earning ability, their lifelong learning ability, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. They're not getting stimulation at that time because they don't have access to services. And the majority of ECD centers that we have, which are daycares or places, don't meet the minimum standards as outlined in the Children's Act, and certain challenges in the way the policy is translated into practice prevent the government support that does exist from reaching the people who need it most. And I'd just like to close this section, which I've given context, by saying that Whatever happens in this early period of life is largely irreversible. So it is very difficult for a child who has not received the services and stimulation he's needed in his early years to actually make that synapse. Because since the way that the brain works, brain plasticity decreases as time goes on. It's actually from the age of 5, and it takes immense amounts of effort to actually, you know, reach that brain plasticity that's needed. So where do we? So I want to, before I comment on the medium-term budget policy framework, I just want to, you know, put this into context within South Africa's policies. And in 2013, the DPME commissioned the diagnostic, is where we stand, and found that our services are by and large inadequate because they provide a limited view of early childhood development and exclude the majority of children who need it, that support children who live in underserved communities. And they also help to provide a number of the essential services, the ones that I showed you on the diagram 2 slides back. So in response, the government has come up with 2 policies, next slide please, and those are the Integrated Policy of Action for Early Childhood Development and the new draft National ECD Policy. The latter is, at the moment, is in cabinet for approval. So both of these policies have focused on moving the provision of early childhood development services outside the limited centre-based model towards program-based support, which prioritizes parenting support and also community services for the youngest and most vulnerable. And I've got some photos from some of our programs there. You can see in photo bottom left, that is a home visitor visiting a pregnant mom, and she's giving her support and educating on how to take care of her health, how to take care of the baby once he's born. Next to that, you can see a community program, which is for children, that's actually being run by the Community Works Program in Northwest. And then next to that, in the bottom right-hand corner, is a play group. So those are all examples of non-centre-based programs. So, to move on to the medium-term budget policy statement, which is the next slide. So first of all, I just want to commend the Treasury for recognizing early childhood development as a core area which addresses urgent social priority, and for prioritizing additional resources for grade R access within the next 3 years and upgrading the qualifications for grade R practitioners, which is needed. And also, the mini budget put spotlight on the 3 grade R years, which is early childhood development by saying, well-developed ECD system enhances educational outcome. However, I want to show you the graph beneath that. That is sourced from General Household Survey 2012. And that shows you the access that children have to early learning services. So they converge at the point where the child enters grade R. But up until then, the poorest quintiles have almost no access. So the next slide. The medium-term budget policy has allocated additional ECD resources, but they are insufficient. The supported interventions, which Treasury is targeting, are too limited a focus because they're centre-based. And they're not going to guarantee shifts in access and quality to unlock the developmental and equalizing potential that early childhood development can bring our country. So what the mid-budget accounted for is increasing the number of children receiving the subsidy by 127,000. So at the moment, approximately 560,000 children access the subsidy. The number of eligible children, so those are children who are accessing child support grants, between 3 and 5 is 2.2 million. So that's a shortfall of about 3/4 of the amount needed, and that's just the ones that we know about. So you can just take a look at how that number, what a shortfall that number of 127,000 is. And then there's also funds allocated to possibly making funding available for minor facility upgrades to 4,000 sites. So those are centres. So the point which I'm making is that the medium-term policy statement is not closely aligned to the draft ECD policy, which is currently with Cabinet. It's not aligned to the framework within which we need to be working, which is one that supports non-centre-based early childhood development programs. And I'll show you why I'm going on about non-centre-based programs on the next slide. that critical period of brain development happens from the period of conception until the age of two. That is what we call the first 1,000 days of life. Center-based programs start with children after the age of three, primarily. So that crucial period of brain development, the child is not receiving the early learning stimulation that it needs. And this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to actually make those brain synapses connect. And secondly, just from a logistical point of view, centers are usually not accessible to the children who are living far from them on farms or small villages. And for the poor children, their parents just can't seem to be able to spend the money to send them there. So in conclusion, our recommendations are we need to see a shift within the next three-year funding cycle towards a prioritization and commitment to the emerging evidence-based ECD priorities. And that is non-center-based parenting support. It happens in the home, it happens in communities, and it has to target the youngest children, so those are the children beneath the age of three, and the most marginalized children. Yeah, so this is the shift that we need within the next 3 years in order to meet our developmental imperatives and put our human capital from the bottom up, because early childhood development is the only way, the only sustainable long-term way to break the cycle of poverty. But children do not process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Rural Health Advocacy Project.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks to the committee for providing us an opportunity to present to you today. I'm with an organization called the Rural Health Advocacy Project. We're an NGO that's affiliated with the Centre for Rural Health Advice. Our work focuses primarily on advocating for the right to have access to health in rural communities, and what that involves is evidence-based research that is aimed towards transforming the conditions under which health is provided, health care is provided within rural settings. So our interest in the MCDPS is primarily around issues of equity and financing towards rural health, but health care more broadly also. So I'm going to go to you on an issue that's more narrow than the general MCDPS. I feel it's an important issue, one that has going forward, potential to have catastrophic consequences not only for access to care within rural settings, but also in terms of access to care more generally to underserved populations. So what I'm going to talk to you about then and perhaps provide some recommendations towards the end is a growing trend in the freezing of posts within the health system, or rather moratoria being placed on the employment of staff. I'm not going to be as naive to argue that we need additional resources within the health system. I think we're all well aware that that's not possible at the moment. So I'm going to be talking to possible approaches to dealing with it and perhaps the Finance Committee's role in overseeing Treasury's involvement in the implementation of these staffing moratoria. So this will be done in two ways. The first is looking at the background for systemic causes to these moratoria. And then really touching on an initial rapid assessment of the consequences of these staffing moratoria. And then I'll finish with some recommendations as to how these could possibly be dealt with. So at the moment of the last 2 years, we've seen staffing moratoria being placed on the filling of vacant posts in two ways. So one is through official moratoria or circulars being sent to managers within health departments, instructing them not to fill vacant posts. And these are often posts that exist on hotel, but there is insufficient funding to actually incorporate people into these posts. The second way, and one that seems to be far more common, is unofficial moratoria. And what happens here is managers, HR managers at provincial level, delay the appointment of staff into critical posts to the point that they're either all of the establishment or they're only filled in the following year or when budget comes available. During the process of moratorium or freezing of posts, what we see is Treasury direct involvement in decision making around the filling of posts. And this is particularly true in contexts where official moratoria have been put in place. It's very often Treasury sending an instruction to provincial departments of health that they are going to be co-managing some of those HR functions. And this is what we're seeing happening in the North West Province as well as Eastern Cape. And to a limited extent in other provinces, even the Western Cape. Well, the Western Cape seems to have dealt with this issue slightly better than other provinces. I'm going to briefly touch on the systemic origins. I think you're all too well aware of the kind of budgetary pressures that emerge out of certain factors within not only the health system but the public sector more generally. So this graph over here is just a longitudinal indication of provincial health expenditure starting in 2001-2. And what you'll see there is that in real terms, and these figures are all in 2014-15 prices, health expenditure has almost doubled in the last 15 years in real terms. A lot of that dramatic increase in expenditure is as a result of the response to HIV and AIDS. But if you look at that red line over there, the significant budgetary pressure has been emerged from this compensation of employees, so salaries and benefits for employees within the budget system. And I think a lot of us here would agree that certainly merit in increasing expenditure on compensation of employees, particularly if it involves increasing the size of the establishment, particularly around healthcare workers, and in certain cases, particularly lower level workers, improving their remuneration. I think, unfortunately, this is not always the case, and there's certain things that we need to understand in terms of these budgetary pressures when moving forward with deciding how we deal with the issue of pros and posts. So if you look year on year over the last decade, the compensation of employees line item across all provinces has increased by about 8% above inflation each year. At the same time, allocations for goods and services has decreased proportionally to the compensation of the employees budget as well as infrastructure. So what we're seeing is that over the period, over the last 10 years, the proportion of the budget that goes to compensation of employees has increased by about 10 percentage points, from 54% to about 64% last year. At the same time, goods and services and infrastructure allocations have declined significantly. And the trouble is that the increase in expenditure on cost of employment has not primarily been on healthcare workers. This is an issue raised within National Development Plan, if you read the health chapter. It was raised in the Integrated Support Team report commissioned by Barbara Hogan when she was acting Minister for Health. And it's been raised again in the NCDPS this year that a lot of the increases in cost of employment is due to an increase in the numbers of administrative and quality level staff within provinces as well as the national level. Since our focus is care is primary provincial, that's the area of concern for us. And this is just an extract from the NCDPS from this year, from a review undertaken by Treasury. What you'll see there is provincial level staffing numbers, and this is across all government departments, have declined over the last few years, with the exception of administrative and quality level staff. So expensive high level staff as opposed to service delivery caterers of workers. In the Eastern Cape, just to give you an example, between 1999 and 2009, the healthcare worker establishment only increased by about 2%. Whereas the administrative establishment increased by 100%, so double. So that's just to give you a sense of what was happening in a province that is under fierce and severe financial strain at the moment. So what we've been seeing over the last few years is budget allocations aren't able to keep pace with the pressure being put on allocations. From COE, as well as medical inflation to some extent. What provinces have been doing for a long time is they've been overspending on their compensation of employees line items. And in the hope that by the adjustments budget, so this time of year, they'll receive an adjustment to their budget from Treasury. And in the past, that seems to have worked for them. The adjustments have compensated for the increase in COE. What's happened more regularly over the last 3 or 4 years is departments also have to shift budgets away from goods and services by mountains to compensate for this. I mean, one thing that you can't not pay in a provincial budget or expenses is compensation of the employee. What that's done is result in accruals being generated year on year, where departments are planning to pay service providers for outstanding invoices for service already rendered. So at the end of 2012-13, we saw Eastern Cape having accruals of 3 billion rand, and this is over and above what are regular or normal accruals where departments will bend at the end of the year and you can only pay those invoices in the following year. Those aren't irregular. These are irregular accruals. In counting the amount of 4 billion. What we've seen in the Northwest, for example, the amount is about 600 million at the moment at the provincial level. What happens then is they recover this expenditure from the following year's budget without adjusting that budget or the allocation to various current expenditure appropriately. So this is snowballs in circles, and I'm sure this is something that you're all too familiar with. So what we're seeing at the NCDPS is that while budgets at the provincial level are increased by on average 2% in real terms, this is insufficient to address the issue of increasing cost of employment. So I think this year the wage agreement was 10%. Which if we look at inflation, is expected to be around 5% for this year, 5% above inflation. There's a continued growth in demand for service, HIV and AIDS, and additional allocations to those areas. The problem is that within the MCDPS, it's very clear that there's no space for bailout. Low economic growth has meant that we've entered into a period of austerity budgets. At the same time, with negotiated increases to COE budgets. So this has become increasingly clear in the MCDPS, with explicitly stated that no funds to expand public sector employment are going to be made available. And the Treasury or Department of Finance has explicitly stated that departments will either need to shift funds from other budget lines, infrastructure or goods and services, usually goods and services because it's a current payment rather than a long-term commitment. All departments will need to reduce the number of staff in their establishments. So a shrinking size of the establishment. And I should say what we've seen in the past is when departments start cutting numbers in their staffing establishments, it's not at the administrative or policy levels, it's at service delivery levels. And usually lower level workers, what we've seen in community healthcare workers, cleaners, porters, nurses, or when doctors leave, they don't replace the post. And this is really speaks to the issue of freedom of post. So what's the impact of this, what is essentially an announcement of freezing of post and staffing moratoria in place on across the board, but in particular large spenders such as health and education. So what we did is we did a brief assessment, a rapid assessment of what's happening at the provincial level. This is both a desktop assessment that I've carried underway as well as interviewed with healthcare providers. I'm not going to go into this in any detail. This briefly outlines what we saw last year in terms of the implementation of staffing moratorium and freezing of hosts. The slide just outlines whether it's a formal moratorium or whether it's an informal moratorium. Just to touch briefly on the consequences of the frozen post, the first obvious consequence is if you're freezing a healthcare worker post or even a critical support post, a cleaner or a porter, it's going to have consequences for service delivery at that facility. You're losing that extra person who's supposed to be delivering services. The other critical factor that we're seeing, particularly in rural areas, is that when you lose that additional person, it weakens the oversight and supervision of junior healthcare workers and professionals, which has implications for both accountability as well as skills transfer. One thing that we're quite careful to argue is that not only arguing that healthcare workers are at risk here, or only healthcare workers are within critical posts. What we've seen a lot of is when a person that's working in procurement, for example, either leaves their position, that position's not filled, within a district hospital or a clinic, for example, procurement comes to a halt. So basic goods and services and infrastructure spending kind of takes place. Again, management issues. The one issue that I would speak to, and particularly from our point of view, and our interest in this particular issue, is that within a rural facility, there's a critical mass of healthcare workers that need to be in place for that facility to function effectively. And what we've seen in a number of cases with staff leaving and not being replaced is you reach a critical point where the whole facility collapses. Doctors become overburdened, nurses become overburdened because of the absence of support from colleagues, and they start to leave. And we've seen hospitals go from 8-9 doctors to no doctors, unable to provide a basic service. So by freezing posts and not allowing for the filling of critical posts, it not only puts at risk service delivery in that point in time, but it pushes the facility to a point where they start losing staff through what we refer to as the domino effect. So what the response, what some of the possible responses, a lot of what came out of here was based on a workshop at the Public Health Association conference where we discussed with district level personnel from health, with treasury officials from provincial departments, as well as national level health and treasury officials, what are the possible solutions. There are legal obligations in terms of how we respond to the funding crisis within health education across the board. The constitutional obligations that need to be met. While health itself is not an immediately realizable right, certain aspects of the population, health isn't an immediately realizable right. So if you look at the right of children to access healthcare, that is immediately realizable. In terms of administrative justice, any decisions being made need to be reasonable and evidence-based. And they must not limit access to basic rights. And unfortunately, what we've seen at the provincial level, particularly where Treasury is involved, and I think this is where the role of the committee really needs to play, is if Treasury is coming in blind without a proper understanding of what the health system looks like, what is our function. So they're placing blank moratoria on hiring of posts without consideration for is this post critical, is it not critical. So the argument is that the National Department of Health, the National Treasury, and to some extent this is the role that the committee should play in providing oversight and guidance, is how a province is expected to protect critical posts in times of austerity. And there are examples of where this is worded fairly well. And I'll speak to that briefly in a second. When we're talking about critical posts, the fundamental aspect of deciding what a critical post is and what's not is what will have the most significant impact on patient care. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a doctor or a nurse. And this really then leads to thinking of ways of resolving crises. It might mean that rather than employing a doctor, you employ a level worker like a clinical associate to perform basic functions and sustain basic service delivery. One thing that is absent from the financing of the health system is cost of recruitment plans, and this goes right down to district level. Currently, districts and provincial departments of health have no clue how much it will cost to sustain current levels of employment or to maintain critical level of employment within their establishments. And this makes it impossible for these departments to decide on which posts are to be frozen and which shouldn't be frozen. I mean, it's a fundamental good practice within any system, public health system or public finance system, which is absent. Our argument is, and we see it going the other way in times of crisis, our argument is that decision-making should be decentralized. And this is something that we see in the Western Cape in response to budget constraints. Districts have been told that they need to cut budget. They've been told how much they need to cut it by. They then have responsibility for deciding where that budget cuts. And what we've seen, and it'll take time to see if this holds true, is that this allows them to decide on budget cuts and limit on spending in a way that doesn't compromise service delivery, or at least doesn't allow service delivery to retreat. And corruption and unauthorized expenditure, what we've seen in cases where budget constraints, performance management involves taking away authority, taking away delegations, and we've seen this in the Eastern Cape and the Northwest provinces. Rather than performance management, performance at the area where decisions should be made, which is the district level. So performance management shouldn't involve removal of delegations. And this last point, and just before my time runs out, it's absolutely essential that all levels and all stakeholders provide guidance on how this should be done. It's not sufficient to argue that you don't have the money and we have restrictions. It's imperative and the constitutional obligations, administrative justice obligations, to make decisions that are fair and reasonable. And that's something that we haven't done very well at the moment in deciding what a reasonable decision in terms of austerity measures. And our concern is that at present, blanket austerity measures, instructions coming from Treasury and Finance saying that you need to control your stock establishment without due consideration for its impact on service delivery, is already affecting services adversely, and it can only get worse, and it's difficult to come back from that once we reach a critical point. Thank you.
Members, we've got 25 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation. My clarifying question, Chair, is on illegal abandon recommendation. That's why I'd like them to assist me and take their recommendation. The current provisions in the MTDS, to what extent are they not catering for your recommendation on the commitment we made for merging evidence-based ECD priorities? Because I didn't get it clear as to what is it that is being made in the current commitment. But also, I don't understand this new concept of non-center-based parenting supporting program and home and community-based care, an early learning program. I understand, of course, home and community-based care for health-related challenges. But for early childhood, to me, this is a new concept. But I'm not sure as to what extent are the current financial commitment catering for those. But at least if you can also make it simple for me to follow. What is it that you are referring to? This seems to be a new program, seems to like space. You know? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Two questions of clarification and one comment. Question of clarification to Producer. You mentioned in your presentation that you were concerned and skeptical about accessing cash balances in the skills levy. I wonder if you could just take us through that argument and perhaps provide us with any additional information and motivation that you might have in respect of accessing cash balances in the skills here. I just want to properly understand the argument and have all the facts on the table. Then a question of clarification to Oliva. I wonder if your proposal is clear. I wonder if you'd consider the cost implications of your proposal, and if so, what are the cost implications over the loss over the NTF? And then finally, just comment on the rural health presentation. I do think that we have to look very seriously at the public sector wage bill, which is clearly now consuming, in my view, too much as a percentage of government expenditure. The point that you make about the effects of blanket moratoriums on service delivery, I think is a very important point. If you look at the budget, the NTBS review, the Treasury make mention of the fact that 12,000 civil servants have left the public service. I haven't drilled down into the number, but what concerns me is the large number of those 12,000 are probably frontline public service, possibly doctors, nurses, teachers, or whatever the case may be. So certainly from my side, your argument will be very seriously considered. Thank you.
Sorry, Chair, I just forgot one question that I wanted to pose to Feluza. I think the perennial problem of youth unemployment is well recorded, and I fully concur that it's something that we should do a lot to deal with. Now, one of the interventions that has been tried is the issue of youth unemployment, tax employment incentives. And I know there's been some voices that are very critical about that intervention. And I'm not sure if the producer is made arguing for reinforcement of such an intervention, or do you have a specific position about this specific intervention? Because I think it's high time that as we look at its impact on dealing with this problem, we are able to say what is our take on it. So as we improve on this area, we are able to take note of submissions from all stakeholders. Thank you.
Okay, can I say some things? So one is just quick reply, because these are big issues and we can't resolve them. Basically, you're running for a new compact, from what I can see. Right? Why would this compact be any different from previous ones? They've not achieved much action. It's embarrassing. We have all these accords, come to agreements, and these little gets implemented. Parliament doesn't do its job. We don't extend oversight of the executive. The executive doesn't do its job either. So what's new? I agree with you. I think we need a new compact, but a new form of it. Modest, with phased approach, with clear short-term, long-term meeting goals. Otherwise, it becomes symbolic. On the legislation for SOEs, I think in our committee report, hopefully the majority will agree. We can only from the check guide. If the majority say no, we can't agree. So for now, I think we should note that the producer is wanting this legislation to be implemented. So I think the majority of the committee will probably agree with that. So I think they will agree. On minimum wage as well, I think there's agreement. That too, I think we welcome. Now, with Elifa Rantwana, I don't know, but I think the majority here would have noted because of what you're saying. I mean, there's nothing, it seems to me you're preaching to the converted. In other words, nobody can question. I mean, this stuff is like 40 years ago, I think, if not earlier, you the experts. It was common sense. It's the sort of thing you teach in sociology one, you know, or psychology one. The first, now you say 1,000 days, but the first period. So I don't think the majority here would disagree with what you say. I mean, I think if we have the money, what is it at all? Let's just do it. So, you know, our empathy is real. What you're saying is what I think the majority will agree with. No controversy. My feeling was you are over-presenting your case. The issue really is where's the money. What we would like to do is to say how we could reprioritize, give an idea. It's important. Not just the Treasury official is here. She will take all the documents, and we will speak to the DG and so on, and look at your documents. So, really, yes, the basic, it's the same as rural health, but it's clear here and there. But the basic thrust of what the rural health submission is, we're going to disagree with the basic thrust. The issues you're not dealing with are, given the constraints of 1.5% growth, given now the need to address the concerns of students, which is like something that's clearing for us, about how are we going to do the things you say? So, the question I want to ask you is, you've been engaging also with, presumably, the Department of Basic Education and the Department of Social Development. You see, you have to lobby my respective portfolios. You've got to go to those committees as well. You see, you can't expect, finally, we'll put in our report that the committee thinks within, what else can we say, within budgetary constraints, these three or four things out of the 10 you asked me, we agree with and things should be done. But you have to actually engage with the relevant committee. And I'm with the Basic Education, Department of Social Development, and the Department of Performance, Planning, Monitoring, and Evaluation. And it's the ministers and the DGs in those departments that must lobby decisions. Because we're looking at the broader thing, and we can support you. But to get something done, you have to lobby them. We also have to lobby society. I don't know to what extent you're making people aware of this. You know? Coming here is only part of a multi-pronged strategy you have to have as far as I'm concerned. Also on North Centre basis, I don't think anybody questions that. We need clarity on it, but who's going to question that? I mean, you know, the other day there was a report saying that close to 50% of families in South Africa are fatherless. You think of that? It's stunning, actually. 50% of families in South Africa are fatherless. What profession is there of reducing inequality in circumstances that you set up very eloquently? And this report, last week, headlines, it says only 50%. How are you going to reduce inequality? So, you know, I don't think the majority is going to disagree with anything you say. What we need from you, maybe you have a bit of time, by Monday morning at the latest, probably Friday afternoon, give us a pretty half page, based on some of the responses you've got here, on what you think we should include in the report. My own feeling, great chair, and others, is that with MTBP, we must highlight the key points each of the stakeholders make. This is their parliament. They have a right to be heard, and they must be read. The case must be read by other MPs, and look at the ACC, and whoever else. And it's for parliament, we elect to govern, to legislate and take part, to say, look, on five things you have said, these two we think we can push straight on. These two, maybe in the next 5 years, this one is not doable. So, I don't think basically, you know, what do I want to say in rural health from my side? I agree with you. I agree, it is right. This thing about generic extension, we've raised this in different contexts. Eh? The difficulty we have here again is you have to lobby the Department of Health. It is more complicated. You're really asking for SCOC to do these things. There are limited things you can do. It's a department, it's a provincial portfolio committee on health. It's the provincial finance committee, if anything, that must do these things because of the concurrent. We can push here this limb. But I think exaggerate what we can do. So I think on most of the things you say, am I correct to say that finally what you're really saying is on page 10? This is your essential summary. Is that on the point 32, 1 through 6? Is that correct? Is that your basic argument, right? And we need as a committee to summarize this and then decide what to think of it. You can speak at me.
Chair, I just want to add, in January, Select Committee for Finance and Appropriations is calling the 9 provincial treasuries. When we do it on a quarterly basis to monitor the fiscal position of that province on a quarterly basis. But then we get a picture of the spending, in your case, in your presentation, health. So you must just check the Z list of Parliament. You're very welcome to come and attend that meeting. Because out of that meeting comes forth the meeting with the different departments, the provincial departments, like health. That's also a platform that you can use. But I think you have to strengthen your networking in provinces, legislators, portfolio committees on health, to take forward what you just presented here to us. This is part of the roadmap.
Just a technical point on the rural health presentation. First, I wonder if we could get a copy of the actual presentation. I'm sure we can get that. Sorry, I missed that. And then to make a point, I think the presentation makes a point that goes beyond health. And the point is this: how do you contain the public sector wage bill and protect critical posts at the same time? And that's a transversal issue which we do have to deal with at SCOC.
I'm wrong, actually. The submission you got now is from NNC. Can you let us have a copy of your... Because it helps. It summarizes. There is something we need to discuss at another stage. This increased public sector wage is a factor. You can't undo it, right?
Now, you can keep raising it, it's your right, I can't stop you. But it's a fact. And even the Grizzly himself, and some of the NC members yesterday and elsewhere, said they have reservations, right? But the thing is that, you know, within these, the fact is that there is an increase. Okay, I just want to say that, I want to say more, but it's irrelevant right now. It's a public hearing. Let's have your responses and draw to a close and then move on to the next session. Can we start with Khalifa, the answer? Good one.
Sure, thank you. I'll respond to your question first, sir, regarding the non-food space programs and what they actually encompass, as well as what government is committing funds to at the moment and what we would like to see the shift in. If I understand your question correctly, that's what you were asking. Okay, so programs and services which are offered to children are divided into non-center-based and center-based. Center-based is creches and daycares. So that's usually a center which is registered with the Department of Social Development and receives a grant from them in order to house anything more than six children. To be in the center, they need to be registered, they receive a grant, and then children go there every day, they get a snack, they get someone, you know, interacting with them, etc. Unfortunately, that system does not work because too many children are excluded, and the youngest children don't attend the centers. So what we're arguing for is, in fact, we're not arguing for it. It's being accepted as a priority by the national ECD policy is a shift, a national shift towards supporting non-center-based programs. And that's basically, for example, you might get employees of ESC called family community motivators, which go from home to home, visiting pregnant mothers, do various programs with them, visiting homes with their small babies, reporting any problems back to social workers. Another example of a non-center-based program is an early learning play group. So that's an environment where small children can learn, and it could be, you know, it can happen anywhere in a park, it can happen in a church, it can happen in a town hall. It doesn't need to happen in an extra registered ECD center. And it can also be executed by one of our programs in Northwest is training community work, CWP workers with COCTA, is training them to actually execute the playgroup. So it's basically, it's all about making simulation more accessible to younger and poor and more marginalized children. And at the moment, the medium-term budget policy statement, which is why we're giving this presentation, prioritized center-based programs, which goes against what the national ECD policies are going towards. So there's a disconnect between the budget and between policy, which has been put together by DSC and by the Department of Basic Education and Department of Health. With regards to your question, sir, about the cost implications of the proposal, and to you as well, Hemant, yes, we are working with DSC, we're working with Treasury at the national level to cost these programs, because ELISA is not an NGO that is just doing you know, programs on an ongoing basis. We work within the domestic systems of DSC to come up with programs of delivering ECD services in the hope that DSC will adopt the programs into their systems and they'll start executing them going forward. So throughout the whole process, we're costing things, we're making budget bits on a provincial level, the provinces we work in are Kesedan and Northwest. So we do that constantly, and I don't have the numbers on top of my head about how much this would cost. I can give them to you. We also work with economists. We're working with Cornerstone Economics. You know, we've got good relationships at a national level in Treasury where we are commissioning us select reports for them on how much things these programs would actually cost. The problem is that when we look at the medium-term budget policy statement, we don't see a reflection that, you know, these things are actually being adopted on a national level, our recommendations, you know, which are evidence-based, which are based on our work with DSD. And especially the concern is this, you know, this sort of looking at the center-based as opposed to non-center-based. And unfortunately, we can't advise Treasury on how to reprioritize their spending. You know, everyone wants money for something. The fact is that education is not a cost center for government. it's the least cost of change for government. And until government realizes this, you know, the situation is going to keep on going on and on. Thank you.
No, no, it's not that we don't recognize it. That's just that we don't have the money. I think that's not fair. I don't say, well, I can't tell everybody, but I think the majority is clear. We said to you from the outset, we are for what you say. We just don't know how durable it is. So why do we do this? We heard you. We're saying, think about what we're saying. It's no use. You cannot say anything. What? We'll feel good. You'll feel good. Right? So how is that going to happen? Can you give us something more concrete? You've got till Friday, is it? Friday, 12 o'clock? Friday? Because they'll be working on the report over the weekend.
Yes, I can do that.
Right. So basically what you're going to do is, you've got what you said, we in agreement with you, give us some idea about how much of money you want. But not how much of money you want, how much of money you think you can get given the constraints we are facing. Maybe it's a tough question on you, but we will obviously tinker with it and so on. Now, the idea is that we will not abandon you. In other words, in HSMTBP, we have to look for it. We can't just write one report and then forget it and write another. Sure. Report, Esther, can we come back to this? I keep raising this thing. It's a building block thing. Last year, we were new here, so we were a bit more, let's say, less rigorous. This year, we're a bit more rigorous. Hopefully, next year, we'll be even more rigorous. But we have to link things. And then we have to have a special meeting with the minister, DG, and the treasury officials. And say, hey guys, 3 years ago we raised an issue with you, by now you should have delivered. Otherwise we're not doing our job. So in short, don't despair if you see nothing comes out of it now. Your job is to lobby all of us, not just this committee. And also appropriations. You know, you can go see them as well. So in short, who will help me and then criticism?
Thanks, Chair. I think let me just start by saying that our engagement here is just a very small component of our advocacy around this issue. I mean, we're working right from facility level through the entire system, provincial, treasury, Department of Health. In fact, last week, Thursday, I was at the National Department of Health at a meeting of provincial HR management to discuss some of their concerns, some of their issues. A lot of the information we're getting is coming from those levels. I think Our key input here is really to start legitimizing certain issues within the discussion. And I think oversight is an important reason to do that in. So the takeaway here for us would be to get the idea of the protection of critical posts on the agenda. It's not a case of asking for more money. I mean, we're well aware that's impossible. But what's the role of finance, treasury, starting to think about where we're prioritizing? And that's a really difficult one, and I don't envy you at all. But this is just a component where something gets into a report that then we can take to provincial treasury, where at this level, it's seen as a legitimate issue, and there's some engagement with it and some thought around it. So, I mean, this base is really just one very small component. It doesn't take very much time, and if it gets into a report that we can use later, then that's fantastic. I'm going to be a little bit cheeky and just say that on where money is, the unemployment fund's got 150 billion rand that's not being used, and I know that the unions are funded a bit of difficulty with this particular argument. UIF is the most aggressive tax that we have in the country. Is it not safe to start thinking about other forms of social protection that are more efficient and effective? And perhaps starting to look at that 150 billion rand that's just sitting there. When we're talking about where is money going to come from. I know it's a contentious issue, but I thought I'd put it out there sometime.
Well, it's not that contentious. I mean, Treasury itself has raised this in the budget earlier, and others have been raising it. It's not contentious. Look, in your case too, by noon, on Friday. Yes. Yeah. There you go. This is the guy he's lobbying. And could ask you in the year later. Look. Can you also, by noon on Friday, give us something that's more pithy and precise? And provided it's consistent with what the majority thinks we'll slip into the report, then you can use it to lobby, and please do. And you can have us a phone number, his phone number, we will support you. But as a whip, you can have your numbers, presumably also, we will support you. Once it's a decision, it's a committee decision. And we don't write reports. We want action. The reports are really a means, you know. And people are all good reports. Can I repeat once again? This is a hearing, maybe a report, but you know, you need like 4 pages of a report, 30,000 pages of action.
Yes.
That's what we need.
not just the treasury, we have the money bills act. Can we drop all that nonsense, right? And really, that nonsense. Money bills act says we have to do this. No. One line is enough. Everybody knows what the money bills act is. Right for what they are saying. The public is. If the MPs don't know what the money bills act, apart from Brendan here, they must leave this committee now. We've been here 15 months. Okay? So none of that, right? Okay, George, there's nothing much for you to say, right? Because we are ongoing with you. Very quick.
Chairperson, let me answer very specifically. The colleague from the DA asked the issue about the skills. The reason why you can't spend it is because it's dedicated. You know, in other words, it's a ring. You know, so the amount has already been allocated for the employers where they can take the money back and so forth. But, I mean, it's overnight labor. We are also not, you know, wanting to sit on a huge amount of money under the UIF. But remember, that's also a dedicated fund because the workers contribute up to 50% and the employers contribute. Now we know, I don't know, it's 120, 150 billion, you know, I think it's a little less than that. You know, so from, I mean, this is our country, you know, so we want to help our country and we want to see where we can make a contribution. It's just that we don't want the Minister of Finance to act unilaterally. To sit down like adults and around the table and we can try to see. But it's not just going to be a situation where we give money to universities. We want to see managers of the universities come up with a plan. You see, and we want to also say at the same time, no outsourcing. All the jobs must be insourced. We don't want to see a garden person must be sit on a situation where the garden services is contracted to an outside person. You see, the university is going to look beautiful. It has to look beautiful. Employ the people in decent jobs through the university because their children also have a right to go to that university. So those kinds of threads that we want to make see happen and to help in the short term. As I said, this is our country. We also want to make a positive contribution, but let us act together. On the issue of the employment, tax employment incentive scheme, the scheme has currently generated 270,000 new jobs and about 29,000 employees have engaged in the system. It's the money that we physically gave to the employees. It is a tax credit. You see, so when they submit the taxes, the amount of tax that they do pay is literally less. Okay? So it's an interesting way of doing it. The review for that program is coming up 2016 and I think we want to definitely engage with the committee to see how we can fine-tune it and how we can broaden it. And also, we don't want to work like a mechanic on motor cars. We rather want to work as a source jewelry maker to fine-tune the process. But I think it's something that's working. We will, by 2016, have gathered enough information and evidence to see how we can refine the program, especially for South Africa, that has a structural unemployment problem. On the issue, chairperson of the growth, for the economy, we call it inclusive economic growth. We want to see that the committee, parliament, those society, political parties, and everybody should, for instance, come up with how do you address the binding constraints. You see, the economy can move forward, but it's a binding constraint that keeps the economy back. So how do you unloosen the economy to move forward, starting with rural development, starting with what we can do to speed up things. I think the whole world is part of that process. I mean, even China, a few years ago, the economy was growing 10%. You know, every year it comes down and comes down. So the things that can make the economy move forward is policy. And looking at what is the binding constraints, what in our view is a better way, and to see how we can provide support. But we also don't want to see the economy growing so that the cake gets bigger. We want to bring more black people and women into the economy, you know, so that the growth is more inclusive and not, you know, benefiting those that have. We want it also to benefit those that didn't benefit in the past. Thank you, Chair.
All right, over then to Jan Yusof. One way in which members please respond, Alan and Peter Paul have sent out invitations to you to the Tobacco Institute conference. Now, it overlaps with Mr. Nito. So I said, I can't go. But if any of you can go, please, there's a Monday you might be able to go. Secondly, there's the Newcastle opening of the South Office. To me, that's going to clash because it's a committee day.
And we sent a message to the commissioner's office, I think, this morning. But if anybody wants to be exempted from a committee meeting, at least one person, please offer your name to Alan, and then the GA wants to send one ANC, one GA, fine. Please give Alan a name by this afternoon, right? 5 o'clock, Alan? Yeah, because we need to let the invited, the host, know. Okay, Cindy, I've done my job. But it was 2 weeks ago, I email was sent out, but nobody responded yet. Okay, Yanni?
Thank you, Chairperson. This is a presentation that I've prepared with Barney Ubar and Adele Breidenbach of UNITA. We are often called South Africa's Fiscal Cliff Committee. We coined the word fiscal cliff, which we summarize as the point where social grant expenditure plus civil service remuneration will be equal to total government income, which is, of course, a very serious danger that South Africa is facing. It is unfortunately true that social spending at the moment, social grants, accounts for about 12% of total government spending, which is on the high side compared to any country in the world. And as you see here, the Treasury's own predictions show that this will continue to grow in years to come. So this burden is growing, it is not getting smaller. At the same time, we saw in February 2013 the promise of government that everybody over 60 will qualify for old age pensions. I have a vested interest to declare in this matter. I am nearly there. But admittedly, it was announced in 2014 that this will be postponed. At the same time, the Minister of Social Development announced earlier this year the intention to extend children's grants to everybody aged 21, qualifying children. Her calculations would be that this can be limited to 750,000 children once fully implemented. We disagree with that. We think it will not be able to limit it. The government will not be able to limit it. If the age is increased, this will cost, in our calculations, once fully phased in, an additional 8 billion rands, and as I'm about to show this committee this morning, we simply do not have the money for more social grants. At the same time, civil service remuneration is a major challenge. Since 2008, civil service remuneration has grown on average by 13.1% per annum, which includes very large growth in civil service employment numbers. If I take you to this slide, civil service employment from 2005 to 2015, over the past 10 years, increased from 1.2 billion to 1.56 billion people, million people. Now, unfortunately, as South Africans, we did not see an improvement in delivery with the growth in the number of civil servants. So, if we had better service delivery, there would have been justification for this growth. With no improvement, or hardly any improvement in civil service delivery, this is really not justifiable. It's simply unaffordable. But I get back to the remuneration slide. In the NDBPS, my rate figure there, 486.2 billion rand, the revised budget for civil service remuneration for the current financial year. Chairperson, this is equal to 41.2% of the budgeted revenue of this year. The estimate is that it will grow to 616 billion rand in 2018-19, and that will be close to 45% of estimated revenue in that year. So this burden is growing, not receding. If we compare South Africa to other countries, more or less at the same level of development, you see that our civil service remuneration bill accounts to about 12% of our GDP, and only Argentina has a bigger bill. And I'm not sure, other than rugby, Argentina is the league in which South Africa wants to play. If we then look at the means at our disposal to get more revenue or better spending of existing revenue of government, we have to be cognizant of the fact that the three most important revenue sources of the government are VAT, corporate income tax, and personal income tax. So if government really wants to increase revenue, these are the three items that one should look at. We argue, as you'll see in the presentation to follow, that government should not only look at more revenue, but also at means to contain expenditure. We developed a small model, an econometric model, projecting the revenue of the government, and as you can see, back fixing this. If government wants to raise more revenue, if it wants to increase its income, it should look at the major income sources. But government should not only look at opportunities to increase income, but should also look at opportunities to spend less and more efficiently in what it is spending on at the moment. We are also asking for efficiencies in government spending and for savings in government spending. I trust I've answered the question. So we built a model. Our model gives surprisingly good results, as you can see with the red and the blue line. And then we built two scenarios, which you will find in the documentation made available to you. The first one is what we call more of the same, continued increases in social grants, old age pensions, and civil service remuneration and employment growth. And in this instance, South Africa is still heading for a fiscal cliff by about 2032, as you will see on slide 14. Now, this is really not an outcome that we want to leave for the next generation to take over the country in about 17 years' time. Hence, we developed a second scenario, which we call New Beginnings. In this case, there are no additional recipients over the age of 18 or over the age of 60 in social grants. And if I say new recipients, I mean people currently falling in the categories where they qualify for these grants will continue to qualify, but the grant recipient qualification will not be expanded. And then in terms of civil service remuneration, there should be no further employment growth. I must underline that. No further employment growth. And then, Chairperson, we can approach the fiscal plateau, as you will see from the results of Scenario 2, but still at an uncomfortably high level. Our civil service remuneration bill is simply too high. This country cannot afford it. I have a comparison of the two scenarios. And then for the way forward, we suggest as follows. In South Africa, it's no longer a case of what we want, but what we can. We've run out of easy options. Unfortunately, with the administration of Mr. Zuma, the country is trapped in a low growth path. There's no leadership and no vision to get this country out of the low growth path. Our best option is to plan for 2020 after Mr. Zuma has left. Sorry? I am speaking to the issue that the country is trapped in a low growth path, that Treasury is wrong in its prediction that growth will increase in 2017. This is an empty BPS, and hence the growth predictions over the 3 years covered by this empty BPS is of crucial importance. And as we see now, over the past 2 years, the country is trapped in a growth path of around 1.5% per annum, and there's no grounds for a national treasury to expect higher growth going forward over the period of the NTBPS, and I trust that I've answered your question. So the way forward, it's not or, it is and. Or, not and. We cannot have more, we have to decide what we want. A critical rethinking of spending priorities is necessary. We are already aware of the fact that free tertiary education will be discussed in Parliament tomorrow. My calculation with my two co-researchers is that the cost of free education will at least be an additional 33 billion rands per annum. There are other estimates putting this in the region of 57 billion rand per annum, which is not in the budget. This money will have to be found. The immediate challenge is the 0% fee increase announced on Friday. Our calculation is that that will put an additional 3 billion rand on government in the calendar year 2016. Remember, students pay per calendar year, not per fiscal year, so some of it will end up in this fiscal year. We've not done an exact split. I apologize for that, but it is necessary to remember that there will be some impact already in this fiscal year, not only over the NPBPS. We have looked at the vehicles made in South Africa. It's quite an impressive list, starting from a 3 Series BMW ending at the Volkswagen Polo Vivo. We strongly argue that government should only and exclusively purchase for the government fleet vehicles manufactured in South Africa. This will stimulate the demand for vehicles manufactured in South Africa. It will result in more employment and investment in South Africa, which will be beneficial to the economy. There is no reason why the government fleet for light vehicles and pickup trucks cannot be met from this list. And I will turn to politicians in a moment. We have also looked at increased taxes. Sorry? I couldn't, the chair, I couldn't hear that at all. Thank you, Chair. We are, as a research group, not in favor of wealth tax, as has been mooted, for the reason that there are problems of affordability. For instance, somebody with a low income living in a very valuable property. The person might have been living in the property for 50 years, but land usage rights might have changed. And as a result, this property can suddenly be very valuable, but the person will not have the funds to pay a wealth tax. And a related problem is one of asset classes. It will only be liquid assets and property that will be picked up, or assets like paintings, etc., will not be taxable. So we argue that it would be more appropriate to introduce higher tax rates for higher income earners rather than a wealth tax. We suggest a tax rate then for consideration of 45% for income between 1 million and 2 million. This is an additional marginal tax rate above the current rate of 41% that's reached at 701,000. And then an additional marginal tax rate of 50% for income above 2 million. And in our calculations, we assume that such higher taxes will not force people to work less. We have roughly about 154,000 people earning more than 1 million rand taxable income in South Africa. Based on our assumption, this will give government an extra 6.82 billion rand. But naturally, better calculations can be made on actual numbers. We have to make assumptions. I have to stress, and I stress that danger of being interrupted again, if this is introduced, it would be morally wrong for politicians to vote themselves tax-free income. I warn against that. It's morally wrong. We had that before 1994. We cannot have a situation where a parliament approves higher taxes and that very same parliament then exempts the income of some of their own members from such taxes. So if the proposal of higher taxes should be considered, it should be applicable to all. There should not be special tax dispensations for politicians. I really underline that point. Allow me to conclude then. We submitted two scenarios. More of the same is no longer an option. We need new beginnings. Civil service trade unions should refrain from asking large and unaffordable remuneration increases. Politicians should refrain from making populist statements with serious financial implications, such as more grants for recipients over the age of 18. Politicians should only use vehicles manufactured in South Africa. The president, the deputy president, cabinet ministers, deputy ministers, and MDCs can be very comfortable in the back seat of a B-Series BMW, a T-Class Mercedes, or a Toyota Fortuner. These vehicles can still be painted black to intimidate other road users, as is currently the case. There's no reason why we cannot stimulate the South African economy in this way. Then I have to add,
order, if Professor Rousseau, please wrap up.
Thank you. This is Parliament, and you are free to speak your mind.
Thank you.
Within the Constitution, there will be no hate speech or tax on gays. We're not doing any of that. But you must also realize that your tone and the invective and the choice of words used will provoke people. And if they're right to interrupt in the committee, it's fine. You invited. Nobody else was interrupted. So it's fine. This committee is not like a formal rigid. We don't allow it. I mean, one of our members here constantly tells me, as a chair, this is my comrade. And I take it to my stride. So take it in your stride. You're provoking people. So you're getting back on things. Take it in your stride. If you focus on the key points you make, which frankly are not new compared to what you said previously, but if you're right, come back. You might get a better response, but you're inflating people's passions here and a whole lot of things, and you bring it upon yourself. But you can speak.
Thank you, Chair. I like debate. So, as long as you allow me enough time, because I also want to add that in addition to the joint submission we made, I want to add, and I did not discuss this with the other two researchers, I looked into the SACU payment South Africa makes to the Southern African Customs Union. This current fiscal year, this will account to 51 billion rand. My calculation is that about 45 billion of the 51 billion rand is development aid, whereas about 6 billion of that is on the basis of the contribution of Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. So my plea is that South Africa should urgently relook this. This is not in my presentation because we didn't agree it, but I can give you a note on this. This is equal to about 1.5% of our GDP, which is paid as hidden development aid, whereas the goal set in terms of the sustainable development goals of the United Nations is for countries to contribute 0.7% of their GDPs as development aid. So my argument is that we should urgently relook and rethink the aid that South Africa gives Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia and Swaziland in terms of the SACU agreement, the Southern African Customs Union agreement. In my view, South Africa simply can no longer afford to give such help to our neighboring countries. We need those countries personally. And we need that money personally. But I must say, this is my view. It's not the view of the Fiscal Cliff Committee. Thank you very much, Chair.
Good morning, Chairperson. Thanks for inviting Kosatu. We appreciate it. I think we also appreciate Chairperson just judging by the previous discussions from the members of Parliament that the committee wants to take a more robust, engaging approach towards the budget long term. So I think it's quite helpful from all sides. And I think we want to indicate that Kosatu would be keen to do any role we can in supporting and assisting our purpose. I think Chair, my name is Matthew. Senator Park, from Kosatu's parliamentary office. I think we also want to indicate for our MPs that we're available any time to assist the MPs in the committee work, the oversight work, and I think even when it comes to visiting provinces, we'd always be willing to assist in linking up the portfolio committee with our affiliates and our structures to see how we best assist each other in all regards. I think, Chair, one of the frustrations for us has been that it's been a bit of a, I don't want to say a toy telephone approach around budget engagement from deadline to Parliament, but we thought we raised our concerns many times, and often they just kind of raise your major concern and then check it as its own thing and off you go. So I think that's always took a bit of heart from what you were saying earlier today, so looking how do we find ways to influence government to raise points in the report, both now and next year and in long term. Something also we're trying to grapple with the deadline to say, Treasury, how can we properly engage around the budget processes? We don't want to just meet with the minister once a year and he has this bit, we respond, and then off we go after lunch. We really want to find each other working throughout the year to say how do we address, how do we meet each other's concerns. I think we can take care that we do appreciate from Minister Nene a bit of a change in approach around engaging consulting. I think we have also tried to meet up on several issues, and we do appreciate that spirit of comradeship, hoping it will increase and achieve meaningful results long term. So I know often that we give Treasury a lashing on this part, but I think we are sensitive to the economic climate that South Africa faces, that the country is facing, the world is facing. But of course, as a trade union federation, we are equally gouged out more so by our triple challenges of 34% unemployment, the most unequal society in the world, massive levels of poverty, and in fact, yesterday, depressingly, we saw that unemployment now increased by an additional 0.5%. In this quarter. I think here while they have this economic growth at 1.5% or 2%, whichever, for the majority of the last 2 decades, we've seen it being largely obvious growth. We do agree we need to have high growth, but the growth must come with jobs. It can't just be growth for profit margins only. We are sensitive to strategic fiscal constraints here about declining tax revenues. And we do support government efforts to drive infrastructure programs. We support the Infrastructure Development Act 2 years ago. We hope that will help to bear fruit, to kickstart the economy, to drive it. But I think more needs to be done in that regard. And I think, of course, Chair, we'll be concerned by the levels of crime and corruption. And I think, Chair, also, due to what the students have done in the past 2 weeks, I think that really kind of crystallizes the level of frustrations across the board on various issues across society. And it's really a useful, if I can say, kick of hands for all of us. I think we all need that kind of thought to get things moving and to prioritize and to really move fast. I think, Chair, I thought one the key frustration on this budget is that it really was business as usual. So we're having this long-term unemployment crisis of 34%. Really feel more radical steps need to be done to push us in the right direction. I think, Chair, we're concerned about Treasury's reducing the deficit too fast too soon. We do appreciate the need to not allow debt level to get out of control, that we can't spend for the sake of spending. But I think, Chair, when you look internationally at the two models, the EU and easing austerity measures being put in place, and as a consequence, we've seen jobless economic growth, versus the US and China, where we've seen governments driving infrastructure, using stimulus to drive the economy to kickstart it. Chair, in terms of public service, the whole public service wage commission, let me just jump into this. We think it's a bit unfair to make teachers, make nurses, make police officers who earn 120,000, 180,000 the same goes for our problems. Unless we say we want to make nurses, teachers, prison wardens, a poverty wage. I think government has done well to increase the wage of the public servants. But still, there's more work to be done. In the public service, you find that the wage gap from the lowest earner to the highest earner is about 1 to 13, which is still too high. But if you compare it to the private sector, where it's about 1 to 30, we think private sector will also come to the party. We need to pay for a decent free wage, and that also benefits the economy. People who have got money can go and buy rent, can buy electricity, can buy food for the family, can buy take the children and enjoy the life a little bit. So, in fact, if you look at the public wage bill, other interesting thing is in the bank statement, it shows that the headcount in the public sector last year has decreased by 12,000. But everyone is silent around that. And where you've seen an increase in the public service intake is at the senior management level, working with about 13,000 senior managers now. And really, I think that's, we need to publicize. Unless we think we're comfortable with having one teacher for 60 kids in a township school, or that of police stations in which the state and younger are hopelessly overstretched and overwhelmed. I think the next country wants to engage, and what they should do is to engage the tribunes on the shop floor, be it an owl, be it a top room, be it a sub-tour, to say, what can we do to be proud of that? Where can we meet each other? What is the fundamental post? What is the necessary post? But I think the previous speaker mentioned about cabinets. I mean, today we have a cabinet of 35 ministers, 35 deputy ministers. Really, I really want to see a project at the top management level then to say, we've got too many nurses. I'm not sure why we have too many nurses or too many teachers. So in terms of the sales state, we do appreciate government's aspiration to raise revenue. But again, we think it's each other's material with caution, because the principle is opposed to privatization, as well as it being opposed to sending off the family silver. We must say that we do appreciate government keeping social expenditure above inflation. We appreciate the growth in real terms in that regard. I think the one frustration we've had with government is that we have many good plans and policies, but too often we do not see them materializing, or they don't go fast enough. Chair, we were deeply distressed by the tax increases in February, March. We felt that we put unfair burden upon lower income and middle income families. That's in terms of the electricity increases, the income tax increases, etc. And we really cannot keep squeezing poor anymore. We know Treasury is testing the waters around increasing VAT, that the Dennis Tax Commission has mentioned an 8% increase in VAT if possible. We will really say that you're squeezing more water out of the stone. And the Cosato would really want to message to give the chamber today that we cannot afford a VAT increase. What you can rather do is look at the increase upon luxury goods, for example, where the rich can afford a bit of self-hating. So I know that you have raised questions, don't just complain, but also come proposals. So some of our proposals are around tax reform, because we also believe that Treasury does need to increase revenue levels. Again, we are opposed to a VAT increase, but would strongly support to provide a luxury good tax. We're opposed to eliminating the zero rating for VAT for such basic essentials like grades, but we also consider that many companies are using that policy and basically keeping the profit for themselves. So if you go to a store, you find white bread and brown bread selling at the same price when brown bread is going to be VAT exempt. So we would support a wealth or solidarity tax. I think we'd also support the use of taxes to encourage the wealthy and businesses to reinvest in the economy, to support local procurement. I think we'd support an increase in company taxes for the wealthy companies. And I think, Chair, we'd also want to really see government's vision of beneficiation being spread along with taxes which support beneficiation and don't just export a raw mineral. Chair, people have mentioned about UIF, as if the surplus of 150 billion lying in the petty cash investment role. It's a bit more complicated than that. There is a surplus, and part of the reason why there's a surplus is that restrictions were introduced on access to the U.S. previously, that if you resign from working, even though you've contributed to the U.S., you wouldn't be able to access it. but for workers, why we oppose the U.S. contribution holidays this year is because this is workers' hard earned tax money. It's really the only form of social security in the economy to lose their job. And it should be used to help workers cope with unemployment. It should be used to help workers who are unemployed for long term. There is an unemployment insurance fund amendment bill which has now been tabled in Parliament earlier this month. But again, the top of the day, it's delayed to that bill for 2 years in Parliament. Whilst we're sitting with a crisis of 34% unemployment, for us it's a quite shocking change. We're hoping that the portfolio committee will be more fast track. It's a good bill. We're going to increase access to the UN from 8 months to 12 months. It will increase or realize maternity leave benefits. It will target domestic workers for maternity leave, etc. So that will partly address the UIF business. But we also have a commitment from the Town of Labour to kickstart further discussions in NEDLAC, hopefully this month or next month, around increasing access to the UIF. To look at the formal sector workers who are not covered currently, to look at maternity leave, adoption leave. And I think so we also have to, from a moral point of view, to look at the long-term unemployed who are not able to access it because they haven't been contributing towards it. So we really wouldn't want to see it being touched for other noble project, designed for a very important project. In terms of the SACU, we really want to see that government, diplomatically, behind the scenes, whichever, put pressure on the Swazi monarchy to accept the principles of democracy. We have a stick to use against them, such as the SACU revenue. I think Swaziland's budget is 84%, if I'm correct, from SACU funds. And really, this is the kind of stuff to help a neighboring state, which helps us during democracy, the people did at least. I think, Chair, the last thing about taxes, that we also want to see Chisal really cutting down the tax evasion, especially among high-income earners. Chair, I'm trying to take the rest of the time because I'm trying to be a bit fast. I think, Chair, we also consider that not just government is facing debt pressures, but households also facing debt pressures. That's why we don't support increases in income taxes for the lower middle income or VAT increases, or the far and above inflation increases that ESCOM fleeces out of the public each year. I think, as Chair, because the economy is still in a very sensitive stage, we're very reluctant when state expenditure levels decrease too far. The government, which is driving the economy, we really need to still not take a foot off the pedal, while the economy is still trying to get out of the doldrums. I think the body makes the public service issue. I think, Chair, one word, which are previous strategies that consider reducing wasteful expenditure, reducing the amount of money spent on consultants, but again, I think much more can be done, and to other departments as well. See, municipalities really ignore strategic provisions. We see too many officials flying business class. We see too many mayors of cashed-up municipalities in the Northwest putting full-color picture photos of themselves in newspapers. There's a lot of wasteful expenditure. And I think, in fact, Comrade Chair, the Premier of Northwest Province recently gave a very interesting and useful comment that in the Northwest Province they found 36,000 ghost servants in the public service. Now, even if we just increase it by 5 across the country, the 3 municipalities, that's where you can save a lot of money. And really, government should look at doing the headcount done previously to weed out that kind of corruption. And you can be sure that corruption comes from managers, who are the ones who have access to the parastatal system, etc. I think, Chair, we are pleased that Treasury has reduced the amount allocated for contingency reserves. We were quite distressed when $45 billion was allocated in February this year. We really thought that money could be very used stimulating the economy. I think we'd encourage them to do more on the national economy, but again, I think we'd want to highlight our concerns around hydraulic fracking in terms of the environmental impacts and impact upon water. We'd want to see more be done to support agriculture, emerging farmers, more to done to reduce the backlog in land restitution cases, which is currently at about 80,000. And if we don't install the sufficient capacity, it might take about 30 years to address that backlog. I think I would also want to see government doing more to address the private sector investment strike in the economy. In terms of the Employment Tax Incentives, Chair, I think we do need to agree with our good colleague and producer. Our concern and opposition around it is that South cannot say those are new jobs because of tax confidentiality laws. There's no information whether those are new jobs or existing jobs, or whether those jobs have been created in any way. There's also no information from South from how many old workers were displaced. So we're hoping that in the review process at NEDLAC and so on, Parliament will get more information around it. But for us, those are the reasons why we oppose it. I think Chair, also alarming to us is that the majority of companies claiming it are labour brokers. While the Saudi government has tried to reduce labour broking, here's a state subsidy to labour brokers, which that is a very painful blow. We do support DTI's efforts to support key sectors such as motor manufacturing, textiles. We'd want to see more being done to support agriculture and tourism. We're hoping that tourism regulations changes will help to sort that problem out. But effectively, maybe more can be done on the biometric capturing, not just for a few selected countries, but for other countries as well. In terms of the extent of public work, the Community Work Program Chair, look, we do appreciate government's declaration to create jobs, especially for the long-term unemployment and employed. But again, our concern here, Chair, that at times, this has become a source of cheap labour for cashed-up municipalities and departments, and what should be normal, permanent, decent municipal or provincial jobs, such as repairing roads, cleaning streets, jobs with pensions, permanency, etc., are now being shifted off and people being paid 67 rand a day. And in fact, we had a long job in the KZN where we had to force the department to stop paying workers with food parcels and to pay them cash. So those are the kind of abuses you see take place. We really want that to be addressed, and we are engaging with the ministry around it, but on those who take to become permanent jobs in the municipalities and provinces. And we do support a program to create 15,000 plumbers and help them help alleviate the skill shortages. Chair, we must say we do support government. We do appreciate government support around the national minimum wage discussions. There is engagement taking place in NIPLAC. It's not moving fast enough. We must say we're really encountering strong opposition of business, which is opposed at a small cost. We support it because, Chair, we think workers need to get a decent living minimum wage. Their current sectoral determinations and sectoral wages only cover about 6% of the economy, so 70% is left uncovered. We're hoping that, like in Brazil and the US, a minimum wage will help stimulate economic growth and to help take people out of poverty and address their apartheid wage gap. I think, Chair, we're also engaging in that lecture on trying to find ways to increase labour market ability, find ways to improve Labour Relations Act, but of course, it cannot be done upon the expense of workers and unions' capacity to organise and to defend and advance their interests. Chair, I think we must applaud government for its excellent work around HIV/AIDS, around life expectancy. Those are fantastic achievements, around social grants. But again, social grant increases we feel are below inflation, or too little. The public health infrastructure is still in a crisis. We appreciate the basic service targets this year or for 2017. But again, we're always worried that every time this thing gets pushed. We appreciate the population growth, urban migration. But I suspect we were not comfortable with the steps because we believe many municipalities don't include informal areas on private land. They believe those being illegitimate informal areas, so they don't count them as needing basic services. So we really want to see with the Expropriation Act coming into play, municipalities expropriating the land on which informal settlements are, and then providing basic services to all our people once and for all. I think we were hopeful that the NHI will finally come before the end of the financial year. We would hope the same would happen with the comprehensive social security discussion paper. I know previous speakers mentioned about the retirement reform package. I think basically our neighbor's concern is twofold. One is that workers currently have no form of social security, by and large. Their retirement savings are the one way of dealing with unemployment. So hence the opposition within trade unions for forced savings. And I think the call for labor in the NEDAC has been that let's have a discussion, but in conjunction with a comprehensive social security discussion paper. So we see what does government do, what can workers, what can the private sector do. Chair, for us, we're deeply concerned about basic education still in terms of what we see about textbook shortages in the Eastern Cape, for high levels of gangsterism at schools, worrying levels that some schools still don't have sanitation, and of course, my school target is still the pushback. Again, higher education, Chair, I think, I'm trying to be fast. We really appreciate what students have done. Really, it's a good wake-up call for all of us. I think we would strongly support a start to free education, both at basic level and tertiary level, quality education. We must all come to the party, including the private sector, which benefits from these skills. I think she would want it to happen sooner than later. We know that there's a possibility that the seat of surplus might be used to assist the budget shortfall government for this year. But again, there can't be a long-term solution because a CETA fund is for a specific purpose, to skill industrial workers. So you can't just abandon that because the CETAs have been training their functions. That problem was also being dealt with. Let me just give you a very basic example. I think there's a shortage of about 15,000 truck drivers in the country. The CETA fund should be using that to help skill such basic skills to help the economy. Chair, for the transport, I think we're quite shocked and alarmed by what happened with Metro or Prasa around bringing in the ill-suited Spanish trains earlier this year. That really is quite shocking. I hope government would intervene there. I think Chair, we're also deeply concerned about working here about insufficient local procurement with regards to the rail project. We're worried that municipalities are neglecting water infrastructure. What we're going to see soon is the Eskom type scenario where there's a massive increase in water tariffs, which hit the poor very hard. We do appreciate government's efforts to stabilize the energy situation. I think now 2 months free of load shedding is a good achievement. I think, Chair, we really want to see government focusing on expanding renewable energy. We've seen 20,000 jobs being created. It's a win-win situation. It's fast, it's quick, it's cheap, it's safe. This is one other message we really want to leave the hearing today with, that Kasata is strongly opposed to nuclear energy. It's very expensive. It takes long to build. It's dangerous for the environment. It's not good for health. Internationally, it's closed to corruption. And the figures we've seen bandied about honest struggle there may be, of cost between 500 billion and a trillion rand. We know what happened to the armed world. We were given a projection, I think, was a 10 billion and triple. Wouldn't you rather see the kind of money being pumped into renewable energies? I think we'd also want to please the pressure we put on Eskom to stop coming with above inflation increases which the poor cannot afford. I think we'd want to see more direction around the postal services. Maybe aware that last week Friday, postal workers only received half the salary. I think other half is coming today. And really is quite scandalous and shocking for Parastatal. It's also popular that the postal office, because of its own mismanagement and corruption, is outsourcing massive amounts of its work. So then you find all postal workers getting a lower wage than the postal workers are getting. These are the kind of issues we need to see action on. Again, Chair, I think we want to say E-Toll is dead. We must accept that, we must move on. We must introduce a form of privatization of access to public roads again. And there's other ways we can deal with towards funding the roads, such as a few levies that we proposed previously. We want to see more being done to provide alternative, accessible, reliable, safe public transport, which most users do not have access to. I think we want to see more efforts brought to stabilize SAA and TOC. But I think that also we want to have a message given to all parastatals that they cannot retrench workers. SAA wants to retrench 800 workers. Telkom wants to do something similar. Yesterday, PetroSA started issuing retention notices to its workers. Now, when we're facing 34% of the summit, how can current parastatals be so sensitive? I think Chair would want to commend the asset forfeiture unit's good work with seizing about half a billion worth of assets. I think momentum to assist at the SAPS. A small note is that we saw $1 million allocated to the Children's Nursery Fund for police officers who passed away. I think the amount is $1 million, and so surely we can do more for the children of our fallen heroes. We do support Treasury's efforts to eradicate corruption through the procurement process to try to centralize issues. We heard that they might do good work around textbook procurement and reducing costs. Across the board there, we support that. But efforts to pay for this with a delay. I think Chair, the conclusion, the point that we really want to give Honourable Members is that for us the key crisis is 34% unemployment, the triple challenges, surely economic business as usual. We'd want to see more from budgets around job creation, more towards stimulus, less of austerity. We really want to say strongly we do not support increases in VAT, but we will support progressive tax reform, we will support renewable energy. We would plead to the members to put a halt to the expansion of nuclear energy. We would want to see more done to reduce wasteful expenditure, but also that we should change the engagement on prioritizing correctly the budget. Again, we oppose to the renewing the employment tax incentives. We are pleased that today UCT, and I think 2 days ago, has announced they're going to phase out outsourcing at the university. We think the government must do the same as committed in the January 8th statement this year by the president. Phase out outsourcing government, phase out labor broking government. We need to move away from privatization. I think that while we do complain a lot, we also do appreciate the significant developmental achievements that I mentioned earlier. I think lastly, we want to see more radical economic transformation. And I think we also want to see more from Treasury to engage both members of parliament, COSATU, and other stakeholders around budget and tax reform, etc. My apologies for speaking so long, Chair.
Do you have any? The situation covers more issues than your actual. So we've got a copy now, Alan. Okay, just send it out to members. Thanks. Can we give Ben Gohan in the meanwhile? Because we're running out of time here. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the presentation that we will make is a brief presentation which directly responds to the letter that you said. Our brief is to make a brief presentation to the committee, specifically focusing on the macroeconomic and fiscal policy position of the country and the macroeconomic projections as reflected in the 2015 MTBPS. You then went further to say you are welcome to comment on any other aspect of the 2015 MTBPS that you would consider being of importance. Now, I just wanted to bring into that just one aspect of it that was not addressed in the MTGTS, but is nonetheless important, and that is the issue of the higher education or public university funding development that met on the day that the MTGTS was presented. Now, the rest of the issues that we comment on, Chair, there is a full written submission that we made over and above this presentation. So there's a lot of details on the in that submission that we made. So that we have given to the committee as well for its consideration. So we will focus on those issues that you requested. I think without wasting too much time, I think we all now know the background of against which this MTGTS is made. Can you move to the next slide? And the next one. I think the slide that is important in terms of what we want to present is that slide there. It basically shows you what the budget for 2015 was crafted based on, and then what now where we are in the medium term 2015, what the actual outcome looks like. So the picture going forward and the picture against which the budget for 2015 was crafted, it does not, those two do not meet. So fiscal consolidation was still declined when the budget was tabled, but it was on the basis of a recovery. The outcome, which is actually the reality that we have to live with, is a different outcome from what we expected. And therefore, we need to deal with that gap in those expectations that we had. And I think with that in mind, and I'm looking at, if you look at the top graph, they basically are your sub-Saharan African economies. So what we're experiencing now is similar, but ours is worse than what is happening the rest of so I think with those words, let me ask Dr. Hamed Amusa, who is my program manager for public finance and macroeconomics, to just take you through the highlight of what we observe here.
Thank you, Mr. Kumalo. Thank you, Chairperson. As Commissioner Kumalo highlighted, that trend there that you see, basically looking in terms of the NCDPS that the minister made last week, a good deviation of about 0.5% for the coming year and about 0.6% in 2016-17. In monetary terms, we are looking at the GDP growth that is left by close to 200 billion rand that the economy can do with or could have gotten if it grew at the rate that it was supposed to have grown or anticipated to have grown when the budget was made at the beginning of 2015. Of course, there's a number of things you could attribute to both external and internal factors. In the global economy, we have noticed that there has been a pickup in global economic growth, but the extent to which that has occurred has not been able to sustain the recovery to 2008 before the global financial crisis levels. And that has impacted a number of countries, especially those that are heavily reliant on commodity exports and those that are heavily reliant on trade, bilateral trade with the top countries, the US, the Eurozone, and China. If you look at in terms of those external prospects and how that relates to South Africa's economy, we have a confluence of two issues. First of all, you have depreciation of the rand that has occurred since 2009. And when you compare that with growth in exports, non-gold exports, as well as the growth in your balance of current account, what you notice is that the depreciation of the rand has coincided with negative trends in both your current account deficit as well as the volume of your net exports. And this is kind of going against the grain because depreciation of the rand and so on should create a basis of making your domestically produced goods cheaper and therefore attractive in export markets. But that is not the case. And we see that for a number of reasons. chief being the fact that China, which accounts for close to 80% of South African, over 80% of South Africa's commodity exports and over 50% of South Africa's total exports, has experienced a slowdown in its own growth. As many of you are aware, China is basically shifting or rebalancing the economy from being export-oriented and investment-driven to being more focused on domestic consumption and the services sector. So in doing that, rebalancing its own economy and shifting its own priority, it basically is moving away from the investment-driven growth and the demand thereof of metals. And China being the largest importer of exports of metals in the world, that has translated to declining prices in the global economy. And also, that has had a knock-on effect for South Africa's mining industry. And those domestic internal growth prospects are kind of hindered, because what we see is that already within the mining sector, the uncertainty that abounds has had an effect. The mining sector during the growth years of China had investment plans to expand their investment, their local investment, and mine growing demand. But now that has changed, and despite the fact that there has been experienced depreciation in the currency, the slowdown in demand is basically affecting their own growth prospects. And what we are seeing is rising tensions in that critical industry. And that necessitated earlier this year a compact between government, business, and the mining sector themselves to try to stave off some of the unforeseen effects of the slowdown in global demand for metals. We also note that there are a number of infrastructure bottlenecks that remain. Well known. Issues around the electricity supply constraints, issues around the need to formulate coordinated policies that are able to ensure that the small and medium enterprise sector is able to absorb quite a high number of the labor struggles that South Africa faces, and issues around the efficiency of government's massive infrastructure spend across the 3 years of government. In terms of the public debt outlook, the fiscal debt outlook, we just highlight two critical points. The first is the revision in the net debt to GDP ratio. In the 2015 budget, the estimate was that it would be about 43.7%. It would stabilize at about 43.7%. But what we're seeing is that there's been an increase to about 45.7% compared to what you had earlier. From the Commission's point of view, the small uptake in deficit and in debt-to-GDP ratio is a small price to pay if we're going to have to contain or mitigate against the effects that South Africa is dealing with at this time, and especially in light of the fact that compared to other emerging market economies, South Africa's debt-to-GDP ratio is not as fast or not as huge as you have with countries like Brazil, India, or Russia. We also note that there's a decline in your primary balance, where your primary balance is essentially the difference between government revenue and non-interest expenditure. So this points to the fact that government fiscal consolidation is still on track. They're committed to it, and they're committed to reducing the overall budget deficit. In terms of the risk fiscal outlook, I'll skip this slide and stick to the main one, which is the wage bill challenge. Over the past 4 years, what we have noted is that after the recession of 2008, government undertook measures to try to reduce, one, the headcount, and two, the real growth in the wage bill that it pays to the public sector workers. But in terms of the new wage agreement, the above inflation-linked wage agreements, in absolute terms, we're expecting that growth in the wage bill will average 10% over the medium term. This has already wiped out the contingency reserve that the government has, and it raises a critical question that in terms of unforeseen spending pressures or unforeseen underperformance of revenue, what buffers exist for government to be able to cushion those impacts? We have already talked of the possibility of a decline in the agricultural output and a drought for the coming year. And this can have an impact on how government is able to respond to the agricultural sector and guarantee food security. those kind of issues come up when we look at the wage bill against the contingency reserve that have been depleted because of those above inflation linked increases. When we look at the growth dynamics and how that has affected South Africa's labor market, we have a graph that shows three distinct periods, the pre-recession, and the period of counter-cyclical fiscal policy, and the era of fiscal consolidation. And what you see is a mirror trend that during the recession, or shortly after the recession, as the government sought ways to mitigate against the effect, you had a sharp decline in the number of people who were employed, or the growth of employment, between 2009 and 2010. The counter-cyclical measures implemented by government around 2010 to 2013 helped to stabilize GDP and also helped to boost employment through the infrastructure spending program. But now that government has reverted back to a fiscal consolidation framework, we're essentially seeing a sharp drop in employment. And with the continued slowdown in economic growth, it begs the question of how can government best respond to those changing dynamics within the sector. We're observing the significant labor surplus, especially among the low-skilled segments of the working population. And there's a call from the Commission that this graph begins to speak to issues around labor market rigidity that need to be addressed. Issues around the need to decentralize collective bargaining agreements, issues around balancing workers' rights with promoting economic efficiency, issues around ensuring that small and medium-scale enterprises are able to create jobs while facing significant burden in terms of adhering to your labor regulations, which might hinder them from actually doing the efficient role of carrying out job creation. The elephant in the room, as some people describe, is the issue around higher education and training, and what we have seen. We highlight a number of key issues around this, and it's in line with what the committee has asked us to look at. Essentially, the fact that there will be no increases in this current, in the next academic year, as announced by the president, we have both short-term implications and longer-term considerations around the issue of free tertiary education. The first short-term consideration is the obvious one, that is a shortfall that we still are not aware of how government will remove funds. The estimates are between 2.5 to 4 billion from the zero fee increases that the universities will have to comprehend or factor in into their own budget. From the analysis that was done, the quick analysis that we have done at the Commission, the number of options on the table that we think are worth considering if the shortfall for the next fiscal year that universities are coming into need to consider. The first option is calls for universities to reduce their own expenditure. The argument on the table is that if government is undergoing a process of fiscal consolidation, universities also must come to the table and look at which areas they can cut down on costs. The compromise in deciding to do that is that we do not know what implications that will be in terms of the quality of education that universities offer, in terms of the expansion plan of maintaining what they have, existing facilities for the range of students that they have, and also, quite critically, which is essential to the economy, less funding dedicated towards innovation and research, which is a driver in the knowledge economy that we exist. From the Commission's point of view, that is not a desirable option, especially if costs are to be affected in areas that the university is making a contribution to the economy. In terms of the second option, it's essentially to look for state funding to finance a shortfall. And we're looking at three options within the. The first is that within the Department of Higher Education itself, there's a need for reprioritization of this funding allocation to universities, and after that, we probably need to look at extending that across government. The second option would have been utilizing unallocated or contingency reserves. However, that has been wiped out by the public sector wage increases, and there's no cushion for government to dip back into. We perhaps think in the national treasury figures is that the contingency reserve for the next fiscal year is hovering at about 2.5 trillion. And one wonders if that could itself be a measure the government can use to address the shortfall. The other option is that, and this is based on historical precedent, and what the minister announced in the 2015 budget and the 2014 budget too, that there will be implementation of the sale of non-strategic assets to boost the coffers of government and allow perhaps to boost in the contingency reserve and enable government to deal with these unforeseen expenditures that it needs to take into account. From the commission point of view, we think that the first option, where you reprioritize within the Department of Higher Education itself, and universities exercising greater fiscal austerity, especially in non-core spending, can be perhaps a point through which funding can be sought, and perhaps through which it can induce the private sector to increase their own funding towards universities' own costs. In the longer term, the key issue is revolving around the provision of Free Education Act tertiary institutions. This will involve a significant amount of additional funding. Just for the medium term, estimates are the government required if you have to have free education in the region of about 40 billion, and some estimates are actually saying about 71 billion. And remember, these estimates are just taking into account the cost of your tuition, the cost of your fees and so on, accommodation and so forth. All the underlying costs the students face, which are possibly not factored into this, students who stay off campus and require transportation, students who face cost of books, for instance, students who face cost of fees, internet, and so on, outside campus, are not factored into this. And the options around financing those longer term obviously revolve around reprioritizing state funding, sale of non-strategic assets, the increase in the tax body, and borrowing. The Commission has not done any research on the cost or the implications of these. However, we have carried out previous studies which highlighted or which were instructive to the issue of the free funding of universities in South Africa. And those recommendations alluded to the number of challenges that are currently being faced. One distinct issue was that we noted back in 2012 that the funding framework that universities are currently facing is inadequate, especially if it does not take into account aspects of differentiation across universities. Your traditional universities, your high technicons, your former other education training universities that are now CSUNs, all these face different pressures and require a different differentiated approach to their funding if we are to address the issues that are faced at present. I've noticed that higher education is not only on the universities alone. The former FET colleges and the CETs that have been historically underfunded. How are we going to address that historical underfunding? We doubt, because these are institutions that are seen as critical to the uptake or upskilling of achievements which are necessary to the economy, and semi-skilled workers, which are quite critical, which we have a shortage of. And from the Commission point of view, we welcome the task team that has been instituted to review the funding of universities. We note that that a clear system of differentiation is required, but government needs to start defining what it means by free tertiary education. We still do not have any ideas, even though there was a white paper produced by the Department of Higher Education itself. What should constitute free tertiary education? That has to be determined before we can recommend guidelines on how this has to be funded and how this has to be costed in the long run. I'll allow our Commissioner Kumalo to conclude the presentation.
Indeed, very please.
I'm actually not going to the book just there, just for the record.
I just once again appeal to the secrecy. But when we have public hearings, can we add another hour? The idea is for the text partly so that the officials don't all fly in the night before. And those who stakeholders are coming can come in on the day of the hearing. But there are case on dates, like Kosati was in parliamentary liaison office. I think the other thing, not really, I mean, I raised last case, not right. The public hearings on MTBPS. The other option is to finish two just a Wednesday. So we could have vote on certain things, so members will have to stick here until 1:30 at least. Now, I'll kind of guide it by you. We've got 12 minutes here. We need about 10 minutes in the Finance Committee. I would say we carry on until at least 1:15. The Finance Committee meets and votes. Let me even take 5 minutes later, because that's the technical thing. But please, we need a quorum. So having said that, can we move quickly to questions, comments, contributions? Tatandi, next. David, anybody else?
Thank you,
Katie. Right. Good. Over to you, Sally.
I thought we should have more time. I don't know how. I know we are trying very hard to get more time for engagement. But given the challenges we have in the current conjuncture, I wish we had more time to thoroughly engage, especially on suggestions.
Sitting. That's one of the proposals that I've got. Yes. We have been doing it for 2 years. When it comes to the MDBPS,
yes.
I'm going to lobby Paul, and yes. I'm sure you agree. Yes. I want to speak to Sidney, that on this day, on that, when the minister comes with his exempt from house sitting, we're going to hold you for after.
Yes.
So we're working on that. It's not going to happen in future.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to start on a lighter note for Yanni Erosel, that I will want to take him to a township Angoma one day, him to accompany me for him there. No, I want to take him to a Sango home in the township. Last year I listened carefully when he made the presentation. I never commented because I wanted to understand his thinking. I wanted to understand his passion about his criticism of government, but I wanted to listen to organic inputs that he made so that we can engage on those. But he's got a way of saying things like he said, that actually draws more to issues that are on the sidelines than the real issues. And if it goes that far, it should be engaged. For instance, if you target a state president as opposed to the entire executive in terms of policies that they take, as you mentioned, individual names, to be found that way. I think you must challenge the policies of a government if they are not adequate, if they are not addressing the needs of the people. But to want to even assume that the president's term will not come to an end or will be shortlisted, it's premature. I should submit humbly so to that engagement. The issue that I want to look at is the assumptions that he has presented to us. Especially when he was doing scenario 2, where he said there shouldn't be additional recipients of grants. Now, I did not hear him juxtaposing it to population growth or what statistics South Africa has presented about the number of people who are actually contributing to the 34% of unemployment. So if you don't do that, then that scenario will not be applicable, because in the current state, the state contributes to social grants based on the fact that you need to have immediate intervention. So it's not the wish of the state to increase contributions to social grants, for instance, extending them to the age of 18. We want to create more jobs. We want to create a more skilled labor. So that assumption, it doesn't hold water. We will have to revise it, unless if you give me more facts, because unemployment remains at 32%, 34%. So it means there will be additional recipients. And also, we have discovered, in a way, that South Africa is an aging society. And with less contributions to personal income, I mean, personal pensions. Now, if you listen to what he said and what Kosati is saying, Kosati is saying actually cares. That's the UIS of unemployment. He's saying that actually people should not even get to the state. So we need to have a policy debate beyond the MTBPS to consolidate our view as a country on how we look at this issue. Because for government, the trade-off, you need to address competing needs and limited resources. There's absolutely no situation where when you say you might find money, in all the presentations I've listened to, when people say find money, the only contribution I agree with is when they say, can the private sector come to party? Now, I want to ask a question to you. If you don't agree that we should impose welfare, but there's no commitment by the private sector to either contribute to our education system or to taking more employment, because besides that, the salary gap between the managers and your low income earner is so high that itself creates a problem for government. So if you say that we need to look at imposing VAT and personal income tax, but should not look at corporate taxes, it's a given tax situation. When she was the deputy president of the country, introduced Ad Giza. And one of the things he said, he actually abused to the private sector to come on board to help address the issue of unemployment and skills shortages in the country. Some private sector institutions made commitments, they never fulfilled those commitments. Maybe we should revisit Ad Giza to say to what extent was that implemented, to augment the current policies, the National Development Plan, and all other plans that are there. You will realize that actually there's never been a private commitment to the public purse to be able to create the necessary jobs. For instance, the union will argue that, and I'm sorry, comrades, engage with policy methods like musical arrangements every year. I would have liked to hear you raising them at NGC in our cluster. Well, these methods were not raised here, you were there, so you forgive me for. I will not engage with all of them. I don't have the luxury of doing that in front of David Maynard, you know. And from Mazamban, he says, so I know David, when he goes into the house, he does a lot of things. Yes, he did a lot of things different from what our discussions here. You know, and when he do that, he sings. And I don't have that opportunity to sing and then in there. I must provide solutions. So, the issue that for a period of time government has done was imposed corporate tax. And the corporate world was saying, but this is too much on us. And then we opted for a personal income tax of 1%. Nobody, including David Maynard, is happy with it. For a change, they agree with the workers. The most liberal organization in the country for once agrees with the workers and say, no, don't impose personal income tax. It's too much of a burden for our society. Now, we say, okay, fine. Can we look at the Davis Committee suggestion? Should we consider wealth tax? I'll say yes, I'll say no. And you know, this comes from a university professor who perhaps I thought was going to make suggestions. Value-added tax affects the unemployed and the poor above those who are at the highest threshold. If you go and buy a loaf of bread, the producers of flour will pass that VAT that you have imposed for them to the end beneficiaries of it. That's simple, that's ABC, that's how it works. They will increase the price of bread. So you are not providing a solution. How many whiskey drinkers are here in the country? The poor doesn't drink whiskey, so putting more syntax is not going to work. So we need to strike a balance, we need a compromise. We need at one point to come to the table and say, as a country, let's compromise and say, how best can we increase our revenue, giving both domestic and international transactions.
Can I ask you something? Can you put some point of questions? I know you have a right to say this, but we've got to...
I'm going there, Chair.
Right, because when the report comes, we can put our point of view. Okay. As long as people stay here, because we have to vote on certain things, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead. Just round up, please, man.
Okay, let me leave most of the things. I'll only go to one issue. And it will be an issue raised by FSD. I said this has to be debate in an environment of this nature. I just, my mind closes. I will go to a proposal that has been made by the FSD on having one suggestion that the universities must look at non-core spending. We'll want to define this. So what do you mean by non-core spending in this case? Because they will tell you their own priorities. We will have to have clear proposals that you want to put in place. Chair, let me visit that. I have many issues, but...
Do we submit it to the report, your comments? Yeah. Next. It's our 12:48, just reminding me.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try to be as brief as possible. First, two questions of clarification, Susanna. So, you seem very sceptical of the National Treasury's growth outlook over the NTF. I wonder if you could explain why and perhaps give us your own projections. Second, on the issue of higher education, there is a view that the 0% or the 0% increase does not need to be addressed in this financial year. It only needs to be addressed in the next financial year, and there is therefore no need to adjust or consider adjusting this budget to provide for relief in the first period of 2016. I wonder if you could comment on your strong view that in fact there would need to be relief at the beginning of the academic year in 2016. To the FAQ, I think that there's agreement that frontline services in the public sector need to be protected. But when it comes to the public sector and the public sector wage bill, do you accept that the public sector wage bill is now at a level which is unsustainable? And if you do, how do you think the public sector wage bill should be contained over the MTF? Then also to the Fiscal Commission. I would also like your view on the growth outlook. It appears from your presentation that your growth outlook is more consistent with the IMF rather than the National Treasury, and I wonder if you could please just speak to that point. What is your growth outlook and what are the implications of that if it is not consistent with the National Treasury? Then again, the second question, Standing Committee on Finance needs to decide whether to amend the revised fiscal framework and a whole range of criteria, guidelines and acts. One of those is to determine whether the debt levels and debt interest costs are reasonable. What is your view? Are the debt levels and debt interest costs reasonable? It appears from your paper that the indicator you use is net debt to GDP, and in your words, current debt levels are a small price to pay. It would appear from your presentation that you are entirely comfortable with debt levels, in strong contrast to, for example, the presentation from Vista. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to take the opportunity to welcome the presentation. And this presentation, I think, Chairperson, has been very informative. There are things that they have identified or presented to us and are going to help us in some of the things that we have identified, and they are confirming that. For an example, the issue of the SAA. When SAA appeared before us, I asked about them foreseeing loss of job losses, and they said no. But thank you that the consultant is now saying there is this possibility. I think the issue of the wage gap, the different living wage and other things, we agree with all what you have identified. I want to highlight something also that I appreciate, Chairperson, that will empower us and help us. The 36,000 gold employees in the Northwest, and I think we really need to communicate this with our colleagues. It needs to be taken seriously and be dealt with. Thanks for the information. And I think a person, Kosatu having said that they have a healthy relationship with Minister, I think you need to utilize that to your advantage to address many of these issues that you're raising. Chair, It's one thing that I ask myself. These are public hearings. What is that we expect? I want to comment what the FSC have done. They have highlighted the issues and given us options. They presented options to us. And as we engage going forward, we are going to be able to look into options. They have said, they have put something on the table for us to take us forward. But I also don't want, or don't agree, not for me to want, but I don't agree that platforms, as much as we have the right to utilize this platform, they must not be abused. Honorable Tobias has highlighted to that. And if there are things that need to be discussed at a political level, we have a political platform in the House, where ourselves, Honorable David here, Jukuda, and take each other head on. So we don't need to come here with personal attacks, but we expect institutions and individuals to come here, present, you know, solutions to us, assist us to move forward, unlike attacking. So I just want to raise that person that we should not lose focus of why I was here, what I'm doing. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Obviously, wiping off of close to 65 billion from out of our contingency reserve in the long run will definitely have an adverse impact on the fiscal stability. But also, it's shrinking, I mean, the prospect of responding to any future contingency. Now, rather than to be welcoming this movement and achievement, I'm not sure, especially what informed us. But at the same time, maybe we should learn from Consadu as to what is the right level of maintaining our contingency reserves. Because I know the argument of us having continuing care expenses and using our reserves as a way of developing our country, or maybe not tampering with our reserves where the country needs development, is something that has been going on for quite some time. But I just wanted to check with Kwasak. Is there any specific level that maybe you will regard as an acceptable level for us to maintain our contingency reserve? FSC, do you think as expected, because you are a politically established institution, you seem to be having sound advices around how to deal with the fiscal challenges, I mean, obviously, as a result of the development in our higher education space. Now, what I wanted to check is, have you ever been approached maybe to give advice? Because there already is a process that is currently unfolding, and I think on Thursday, tomorrow, there will be some announcement made around the intended approach to the challenge. Now, I just wanted to check, were you ever approached just to say, could you please support your sound advice? Because constitutionally, you are one of the main structures that should advise around issues of the fiscal framework. And lastly, on a lighter note, I was planning to attend the committee this week, but as a result of your input, some of the parts that you put away, I'm reconsidering my option for this weekend. So that's because you have placed at least some few rents for me. I'm not going to spend any money for coming this weekend, but you have already encouraged me. Thank you very much.
All right, let's start with who is first there or so. Yeah. And briefly, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. On the invite for the Sangoma, I'm sure we can handle that privately. I take the point about attacking policies of government rather than attacking a person, which is very valuable advice from the Honourable Member. Thank you very much. On my assumptions, the assumptions Fani, Adal and I used in Scenario 2, some didn't permit going to them in detail, but in short, what we are arguing is, yes, in the current definitions of recipients, we agree they will be grants. But there should not be an expansion of qualifying recipients, like all people over 60, rather than qualifying people over 60. Children to 21 qualifying rather than children to 18. But indeed, there will be more children qualifying under 18 and more qualifying people under 60. But it is a valid question, and we could have made that clear in our discussion on the policy debate. On the one hand, we ask for expenditure reprioritization, in other words, reduction of expenditure on what Kusatu called bling expenditure. It's a very nice word, I must remember, like black car. They're too big, make them smaller. So we ask for a reprioritization on the other hand. On the one hand, on the other hand, we do not ask for higher VAT. I'm very sorry if there was a misunderstanding. We are not in favor of higher VAT. It's a very aggressive tax on poor people. We are in favor of higher personal income tax rather than a wealth tax, as I've explained in the presentation. The structure is already there to raise income tax. For wealth tax collection, you will have to put a very expensive new collection system and reporting system in place, and we are not sure how efficient that will be. And yes, we agree there can be room for increases in company tax, and indeed higher personal income tax on income over $1 million and what follows, irrespective of the tax rate, will result in a closure of the wage gap, whereas a wealth tax will make no contribution to closing the wage gap. About the growth output over the MTBPS, look, historically, all institutions making economic growth projections make an underlying assumption of the economy growing at full potential GDP growth, whether it's the OECD, whether it's the IMF, whether it's the Treasury, whether it's the Reserve Bank, whether it is the economists participating in the annual Economist of the Year competition. Therefore, all growth projections are, in 95% of the cases, adjusted downward. And at the moment, there's no reason to believe that anything is happening in South Africa that will ratchet growth up from the current 1.5% to the 2.4% foreseen in 2017. It's very easy to make such an assumption without giving a reason why we'll suddenly jump from 1.7% foreseen in 2017 to 2.4%. 1.7% in 2016 to 2.4% in 2017. We just don't see an underlying set of assumptions supporting such an outcome, and therefore our assumption is that growth will stay where it is. Then, as far as the fee increases over fiscal and calendar years are concerned, the big concern is the NISPA disbursements are done on a fiscal year. And this leads to a problem of funding for universities where students register in January and February, but they only get NISPA money in April. And I'm merely warning about a repetition of a similar situation where universities might need funds earlier and government can only put it in a later fiscal year. But if agreement can be reached between universities and government around this one, naturally the difficulty can be overcome, but it is an issue, in my view, that should be flagged. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Mayor, in terms of the public wage bill, look, from our research, it's basically in line with the national norms. We don't see it as increasing incompetently. But I think what's missing from the debate is that the government has changed since 1994. This is now a government which caters for 100% of the country. Before 94, it catered for 13%. There has always a need to increase public service at all levels, from policing to hospitals to education, etc. So that's why there has been a significant increase which was needed. In fact, there's even more pressure because government committed itself correctly to employing early childhood development teachers for grade R schools, community health workers, etc., to reducing the police to public population ratio. I think for us what we really want is they're not blind that you can't just spend willy-nilly. I think for us what we'd rather see savings around the goalpost, literally. We must go door to door across all departments, across parastatals, across municipalities. If in one province, a 10-year province can save 76,000 gold stones. In a small province, by the way, not a big province. But more can be throughout the country. I think that will really help us to have a better picture. I think you also around the same issue that you do have some vacancies which have been filled for 3 years, some of the unfunded vacancies. You can also look at those areas. But again, it can't be around cutting badly needed posts in the police service, education, health, etc. Also what can be useful is to look at whether the big growth in public services around the top management level. It can't be right where you have 13,000 senior managers. Yes, there is we have a shortage of teachers. I think also share the same point that you will find scandalous that in the past cycle, the CEO of the top management getting paid 3 million rand, 4 million rand, some even 12 million rand. Yet the president of the republic gets paid 2.5 million rand. It just doesn't make sense. And there again, this would be useful for treasury to intervene. We're looking forward to the SOE bill coming soon, hopefully, to try to introduce the proper check and balances and controls. I think, Chair, we can also see within side of the public service wage agreement this year for 3 years. I think that all minutes of treasury in terms of no projections for the 3 years of better stability in that regard. On Lord Ziglady, we're glad he has caught on to the issue of the SAA and the 792, if I get the number right, retention. But of course, the SAA, in the post office is complete chaos in the key. Telcom says massive amounts of outsourcing labor programs. Petra says, issued yesterday, the plan to offer the various packages. So we really want to see government intervening through treasury, through public enterprises, to show that our parastatals follow government policy. The president correctly said, we'll end outsourcing. We want to see our parastatals doing that. We want to see them ending labor brokers. We are hopeful, Honorable Chair, that our engagement with Kumbanele, our retirement reform might yield some meeting of minds, hopefully. I think the last question to Honorable Van Rooyen. On the contingency reserve, look, we're not saying that you can't have some reserves. You must have because of drought, flood, whatever disaster may arise. Our concern is that there was a massive jump in allocation in February this year. I think from about 5 billion to 8 billion, up to 45 billion for contingency reserves. So that's too high a jump, given the level of unemployment crisis facing us. We'd be more comfortable, I think Treasury would probably be better placed with the actual numbers, based on previous experiences, but a small figure of around 15 billion thereabouts, you know, without unpacking too much, like for us. The 45 billion jump is just too much. So we were happy that it was reduced a bit. Last few issues, Chair, that the Rand Provincial Administration has recorded about 6 billion in surplus in the budget statement, which again to us is a scandal when people are literally on the breadline and the pop is overstretched. In terms of the UIF surplus, I forgot to mention that most of the surplus is actually tied up in investment funds. There's not cash available in the debt store. But when we had engaged the Treasury earlier this year on a UIF contribution to holiday, we said, look, the available UIF surplus there, which is about 15 million rand, we would support using it as an interim measure to assisting the IDC, for example, on job creation projects, which have been done previously in 2008. Unfortunately, in our shock, Comrade Chair, Treasury and the Department of Labour told us that the government doesn't have capacity to spend the money. It will just simply be rolled over. I hope in the future we'll be able to overcome such kind of responses. And I think lastly, Chair, I'd like to note, since the cars are quite popular, the Pope, when he went to the U.S. recently, he was received in a small black Fiat. Maybe that's a good example for our leadership at all levels of all parties to adopt. Thanks, Chair.
Very quickly to the other person.
Just a question to Kosatu, also on a lighter note. I wonder if Kosatu would be prepared to support my proposed amendment to this budget to cut 540,000 rand of expenditure on bills for reproductive purposes allocated to the Correctional Service Department. We feel strongly that that wasted expenditure and could possibly be better spent, for example, in higher education. But does Kosatu agree?
I'm at a loss for words, Chairman.
Sorry?
I'm at a loss for words.
Yeah. All right, if you see very quickly, please.
Yeah, very quickly. Please respond to Honorable Sophia's question on NANCO. A typical example of NANCO spending in the context of dealing with this short-term measure that government has taken is if everybody can decide to do what one vice chancellor did and said that my 900,000 bonus I will not take. It's also that typical. I don't know what other such types of expenditures still exist and at what levels. Are those paid and on what basis? So it's those types of issues that we are thinking about, because immediately this happened,
there was a speculatory story which suggests that we were probably not thinking in the mode in which the broader government has been thinking since 2010-11. Now, the next question that I want to respond to is, Honorable Mainia, your question is around the debt and the amendment. You would recall that when the conversation around this was started, around the amendment bill itself, and the government came in with this issue of whether we need to implement certain rules around debt, around spending. Do we want to implement rules? We don't have a rule on the debt level as Parliament, and I think it was agreed that you know, our system legislatively does provide for how you manage those, and so it was probably not very necessary to start imposing those. Now, on the expenditure side, though, starting with the fiscal consolidation phase after the countercyclical phase, you then had a government tabling budget that came with expenditure ceilings in certain areas, and that began to talk to what must then happen on the revenue side if those expenditure ceilings have to be shifted. So at the moment, what has been happening is that you have been managing the growth rate of public debt. It's been growing faster, which is why a lot of people get alarmed. So it's growing so fast, it's burning, literally burning. Now, you want to manage the rate at which it's growing relative to your economic growth. And so we saw this year there's another fiscal rule that has been imposed that tries to link your growth in public spending to your what you would assume to be your natural growth path, as it were. So the management of that is actually within the... So for our part, when what we see, why we're saying that it's not something that one should be alarmed about, the only thing is that it's slowing down. Pace at which borrowing is growing, it's slowing down, even though the projection had to be revised, and it's mainly driven by the economic growth outcomes and outlook going forward. Now, I'll ask Hamed to respond to your other part of the question, which is about our growth, how we deal with our growth rate outlook. Now, Honorable Van Rooyen, your question, have we ever been approached on... I actually heard about announcements that you made yesterday. I heard about that in the news, so I have not, we have not been. But I think what is important to us is that we are established to make recommendations to Parliament. So the primary focus of our recommendation is for yourself. So whatever is tabled, if it has financial and fiscal implications, as you just recently passed the FSC Amendment Act, you will be able to pick it up whether you need to approach us for our inputs. But I think we have taken that initiative to put some of the thinking that we have. But again, I must also say that in the past, 2011-12, we already made recommendations that almost like anticipated what happened, because we did say that the fees were growing at such a fast rate that at some point they will not be sustainable for the parents that must pay the fees. So we did raise those issues, and unfortunately at that particular point there was no response to that recommendation, but we did raise it even with Parliament that this recommendation has not been responded to, and it is still there today. Just talk to that a little.
Just having what Professor Rousseau said earlier, what he said was, I'm hoping that I did not make even with the confusion, I apologize. The IMF statistics that I put there were just to show that across the board, the projection about South Africa's growth forecast are on a declining trend. And the IMF was not too far off. Even the NSC's own scenario planning was not too far off, because we dealt with a severe episode where you have protracted slowdown in economic growth for a period of time. Those projections from Treasury come in line or come close to what they have predicted. So you can be off by a small percentage point of that, but generally, the trend is still speaking to the same thing, that you're having a decline, a slowdown in your growth of economic growth in line with all projections.
For myself, I've got a few issues, not least to Kosato, but I think we'll leave it outside and turn into the report and leave it to your side of the meeting. With you to close out, and the Finance Committee, I'm sorry.
The FCC mentioned that they had a longer presentation. Will we be, a longer document, will we be receiving that?
The committee.
It was submitted yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, and yeah, it was submitted yesterday to the...
We'll check on that. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Quite a document. To our stakeholders that appeared before the committee, thank you for honoring this engagement. It's very important that you speak to us and stimulate the debates. Bring ideas to the table. Secondly, objective good governance and financial management. Spend money wisely. That's where we are accountable, where we also go back to our constituencies and address our people on Monday, that's your constituency day, and during constituency periods. To our honourable members, thank you for your questions, your participation. Our next joint meeting will be, I believe, on Tuesday, when we will be dealing with the report, co-chair, and then it will be tabled in the house, both houses on Wednesday. July, am I correct? Next Wednesday, it will be in both houses, in A and in COP. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for chairing this session.
All right, thank you. I refer you to the report which was sent to all of you yesterday. There's you were in charge of this report, as you can just tell us. I don't think I'm going to say it. It's really from 84 onwards, your findings and your recommendations that are the key. The rest is just a summary. I've noted some minor technical glitches, right? Which I can correct, grammatical and so on later. But now into the content. Thanks. Over to you, then.
Thank you very much. On the introduction, we have made some addition there because it only speaks of the attendance at Devonport. It's not saying anything about the Cape Town attendance. So for it to be a complete and true reflection, we should talk to the attendance of both there and Cape Town. And then let's go to page 2. The last paragraph there is just giving indication of the item that has been recouped, but it's not giving any monetary value to that. So the monetary value in the corrected version is cited. And then let's go then to observation, that is 3.14. It also came to the attention of the committee that the management of the warehouses meant to store illicit goods and need major improvement. That's the observation that we are including there, and it will come in at 3.14. And the recommendation on 4.3, because we are speaking there of amend gates, and these amend gates, these are what we refer to as porous entrances that allow illicit goods, to come into the country. Now, the recommendation that you are bringing in there is hard to ensure that all unmanned gates are meant and high-tech measures are introduced. And then the last recommendation that has been brought in here is hard to improve the management of warehouses meant to store illicit goods. The introduction of sophisticated high-tech management systems to be considered. And those are the only few points that I wanted to add on this report. Thank you very much.
The wind on that trip, do you want to add anything?
No.
Sorry,
Chairman, there's nothing of any substance. I'm happy with the additional recommendations. But in terms of, perhaps I could liaise with someone outside in terms of a few grammar comments.
Yeah.
The
inspector question, I'll talk to that. Well, did you want to help?
No,
please, because I picked this up. But Okay, I will agree with that, but I won't change the content. So if that's the case, can we move up for the report? To Kalevi, a second then? So there's no second, we'll have to re-meet again sometime, I'm not sure when. Okay, fine. Good? Okay, let's pause the doctor. The next thing I want to say is, can we make this a policy? Within 2 weeks of a visit anyway, the report must be given to the chair or the chair. Right? And then within 2 weeks of that, we must vote on it. It's unacceptable that we go in July and we're voting now. Okay. The same will apply to the minutes. I think instead of doing it at the end of each quarter, we should do it at the end of each month. Okay, can you help us with the minutes?
I'll table them formally. Previously, we've adopted them, you know, but if we want to scrutinize them, so maybe we change rules. As far as I'm concerned, there's nothing I have to say. On the 23rd of June, can we move and second it to the rest? It's a straightforward one, as you can see. Particularly, a second of these. What we will do it. Okay, thank you. Move for 4th of August. Minutes. Chandi, are you participating, Chandi? Chandi? You were at the meeting, right? So if you could kindly help. Otherwise, it's going to be just two people. So a mover for that, please. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
I know that Mazamba and myself, but the initials are RA, and for the history, when my descendants look back there, they might not recognize
it. Okay, fine. Okay, then the 5th of August, please, Mover. Thank you, Kendra, thank you. 11th of August, thank you, Charlie. Yeah.
I actually reckon this is when I was not there, and apologies not to be said. I send all apologies if I'm not going to make it.
Well, it's only the six to get our apology. Yeah, if you get
I don't remember not coming to a meeting without an apology. And there are three types of
people. I'm going to the other meeting,
if I can analyze what I was just saying. I also refer that they should be considered in terms of the naming. In other meanings, but in my language, other to this, in my language. For me, it is. But then, but on this three meetings, I'm not sure, because on the other meetings, that the whole that way I was not available was busy at school.
No, I think in fairness, on this matter, there are many times, I go, in fact, almost every meeting, I ask Alan and the group, and often members are not submitting. So that's between the group and you and Alan and you. But if we don't have a written, if you presume using an email, you will make that available to us. But we are not going to use this meeting to settle those issues. So I'm ruling on that matter. It's out.
Right. Unless we can be able, but we will not.
That's formally until people come back to you, they have till Monday morning to prove that they sent you apology. But there's no such thing that I know that retrospectively people can provide them. The obligation is on the member. In fact, one of the issues of critics.
You see, people will ask for more time. But frankly, why don't we not fight? Nobody comes. The 3-5 is better than salary. We're public hearing here.
Chairperson, if you have to discuss that, let's do that. Yeah. I also, on the first Friday, I made an apology. On the other Friday, it was you and me when you were at ground. I was there.
I'm saying that members must get free. Okay? We are not, I'm ruling on the matter. We are not discussing here whether a person was there or not. I'm not entertaining it anymore. People must produce. Now I'm suggesting, apart from theirs, people must email me and him so that I actually can check with him.
Right. Somebody
move and send. Thank you. Yeah. Somebody take it right. Thank you. 18th of August. Thank you, Dave. Thank you. 19th of August. Thank you. 25th of August. Thank you. 26th of August. 26th of August. No. Right. 1st of September. Thank you. 2nd of September. Thank you. 8th of September. Alright, thank you. 9th of September. Thank you. 15th of September. Thank you. We went to have done this in last week of, I think it should go on record actually, I'm putting this on record. We were meant to adopt this in the last week of the last quarter because of the poor attendance in the 2 weeks before. We were embarrassed and then decided to call off the last sitting. So I want to plead with members that we do the 10th meeting of the committee. Thank you very much for your attention and time. Sorry, you want to say it very quickly.
Chairperson, just on the whole question of the MTBS, I mean, it appears that there wouldn't be a further opportunity to meet the National Treasury given the timeline. There are three pieces of information that I'd like from the National Treasury which would help, which would assist me and, I should imagine, members of the committee in their deliberations. I wonder if it would be possible for us to agree that we write to the National Treasury and ask them to advise whether there were any changes in provisions and contingencies in this period, because if you look at that, we have to consider the whole question of contingencies, and there was no information in the budget books about contingencies. So whether there have been any changes and additions in respect of provisions and contingencies, and then whether we could also, whether they'd advise us on the current status of the public service debt, for public sector debt, I beg your pardon, and the public sector borrowing requirement. Those are sort of three filings in all the documents.
That has gone through my mind. I was going to raise this elsewhere, but I think it's important. This is Parliament. We have to do our job. This idea that we have people make submissions on the medium-term budget policy, which is so important, and Treasury does not respond to it, is not correct. So I'd like to propose it's not the correct thing to do. I don't know where this comes from. When we have those, the public comes, they reply, then we listen to both sides and we take decisions. Why on MCBPS then? The thought has occurred to me, Treasury should not just send an official here. I asked the Secretary, somebody else in Treasury, they should reply to the issues. So what I'm suggesting is we are amending the Money Bills Act, but I think we have to sit more regularly and we have to do our job properly. I would like to hear Treasury reply to all of these things. We don't get a chance to do that. So that's the first thing. Secondly, you have the right in terms of the rules to ask any question. And as far as I'm concerned, you are right. I will consult with Bris, and if you can give us the questions. If there are answers and the Money Bills Act requires it, we must just do it. I don't care who it comes from. It is Parliament. And I'm not happy about the way you do this thing. So the first thing I'm going to do is speak to Paul now in the House. We can write a letter to the House Chair. Of course, what you can say to me is, truth is, you can't get a minister here from 12:30 to 2, right? So we're going to seek an exemption on the Thursday. We're also going to seek an exemption for public hearings, right? And can public hearings properly. And then we want to reply from sessions before we put things in a report, because that also gives Treasury the chance to actually have it say, instead of us just listening to the public and being impressed by what people say, particularly, for example, Somali Kusatu, we're not hearing Treasury side. So I'd like to advise that unless someone rules it out, we do our job properly, which means more time, and Treasury will come back there to reply. I don't know why Treasury is not called here to reply. Then you can make a balanced view and say, this is what the public is saying, this is what the committee is saying, this is what Treasury is saying, now let's do our report. The other thing I'd like to urge members is we will get the report to you within its two committees. And I'm available, actually. You know, I've got a meeting on Sunday. I'll work on that report. But, you know, by the time exchange and so on, you only get the report on Monday morning. So the deadline would be, Alan, because you're the only one here right now. I think by noon, the report must be sent out to committee members, so that they have enough time on Monday to the following morning to make a comment. How about that? Okay, good. All right. Thank you all. Sorry.
Chair, just to say, I mean, I would support you in sort of rethinking the, they call it the approach and the program when we do this again, and I certainly agree with you, the National Treasury should respond. I also think when we task the Parliamentary Budget Office, perhaps the other entity, I mean, there are certain guidelines in Act. This whole question of, is it, for example, reasonable? That's quite a difficult question to answer, but it would be very interesting to hear what the Budget Office, Treasury, and other entities actually make of that. What criteria would they use to assess, and what is their assessment? But my general point is,
all of us across parties last the question, we have different answers, right? But that is the correct question to ask. That's our job. It's in the Act. The very Act, the majority in the party checks. So I don't think there's any problem. Whatever the Act says we must do it, or go and change the Act and say, the Act binds all of us. So we must just do it. The thing of going through the process is over. While I'm here, I don't care what happens when I'm not here.
But the job is to do my job as a chair. I'm telling you, we're going to do what the Money Bill Act requires. In fact, what I would like is, I think we'll look at the Money Bill Act 12 by 12 very early in the new year. Really, because I've got a 13 question to you. No. I also want to tell you something. This committee has raised it since we here very quickly. This thing about, it's an ANC committee, guided by ANC policies, that the productivity of the public sector workers leaves a lot to be desired. Especially for that in Democratic Teachers Union. I say it on a forum. You know where I belong. And those comrades are here. I've said it openly there again, right? You must understand that your case is increasingly weak, right? For the public sector workers. It's been raised by Kandi, it's been raised by Makosi, I think it's been raised by other people in the ANC, let alone other parties. That, you know, I have a lot of questions there, but let's think it through, and let's see how we manage the process. What I'm saying in short is that it's great to keep. That I'm sure Charles has many questions to ask. I'm about to ask about, well, 13 to you. The one thing I want to communicate, people are free to come and say what they want to say here. But this idea that Yanni has that we must cut the social welfare thing is not wrong. Not when you have such high unemployment. Nobody in the majority party will agree with that thing. That you must move people from welfare to work is correct. I think some people will agree. But the idea that we must cut it, the welfare allocation, it'll be a disaster for this country, whichever party you come from. So I'm going to tackle him and so on, but I think Sandy, that was the same and others. There's a lot I wanted to say, but I just have almost a cut it. So in short, comrades, let's do what Bill actifies us to do. Thank you all for your time and attention.